Good morning, everybody. This morning we announced to our staff that Turner Broadcasting, Time Warner, has sold WCW World Championship Wrestling, Inc. to Fusion Media Ventures.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
We like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me!
Delete! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
That was a little throwback clip there to a time when we all thought WCW had been rescued, but it was not meant to be. I played that for a reason. It's going to be clearer once I get into the AEW news. But this is episode 595 of the Solid Monster Sounds Of here for Sunday, April 14th, 2019. I am the Solid Monster. I push my WrestleMania 35 review out to the feed as episode 594, the day after it went up on YouTube. Hence why this is 595, so no, I did not skip a number. Thank you, everybody who keeps using the Audible link, including all you who used it over WrestleMania weekend. I appreciate the support. You can sign up for a 30-day trial of the Audible service, as always. Get yourself a free audio book during that trial that you get to keep no matter what. All you have to do is plug in the link audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up, get yourself a free book. One book that is up that I have not mentioned before. If you are a pro wrestling fan, if you are a fan of Japanese wrestling, New Japan Pro Wrestling, Wrestling at the Tokyo Dome, there's a great book by Chris Charlton, who sometimes you hear on New Japan World providing English commentary. And actually, he may have been part of the announce team for some of the matches at the G1 Supercard at MSG. I believe he was. I'm not 100% sure. I was there live. I didn't see it on TV. But Chris Charlton, he is a student of Japanese pro wrestling. He is there many times to help translate because he understands Japanese. He can speak Japanese, and so he can translate when there are wrestlers in New Japan doing a promo. They rely on him for the translation. Anyway, he authored a book on pro wrestling in the Tokyo Dome called Eggshells. And if you would like to check it out, there is an Audible version available. You can use your link, your trial, to cash in and pick up a copy, the audiobook copy of Eggshells. So again, audibletrial.com/solomonster is the place to go for that. Also, you want to become a PayPal VIP, you can do so at any time on thesolomonster.com. No pressure. $10 or more, as you know, will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. I want to say thank you to our VIPs this week, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Luis Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Pesera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Luis Hercules Hernandez, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Stephen Handyman Halistic, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Luck is for Losers Lance Flint, the Demon Temptress Samantha Krasinski, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Bearclaw, Wendell Baugh, shout out to Wendell, one of our moderators in the Facebook group. Recon, Russell Bulware, Handsome Harold White, thank you. Jamal Wiseman Williams, the Bangkok Bandit, Nipit Viramatikal, I hope I pronounced that the right way. All In, Alan Pierce, it was great meeting you as well at the Wrestling Soup event last weekend. And a shout out also to Machine84. For the iTunes love, thank you very much. The Irish Wolf, Simon Peter Munoz. He'll be wrestling for East Coast Pro Wrestling on Saturday, April 27th, 7:30 p.m. bell time at St. Virgilius School, 9915 Rockaway Beach Boulevard in Rockaway Beach, New York. The Powers of Pain are going to be on that show as well, wrestling for the ECPW Five Boroughs Tag Team Championship. You can buy tickets right now at ecpw1.com. That's ecpw1.com. Also, real quick here, a few weeks ago, I mentioned a friend of mine who is a school teacher, had a former student of hers named Khadijah. She's 10 years old, And I mentioned that she was in need of a kidney transplant. She was on dialysis. She had an urgent need. And I just mentioned her situation. I mentioned her page, which was on the official kidney registry website. I'm happy to say that she found a donor match, and she is slated to undergo surgery later this month, which is awesome. That's awesome news. And I want to say thank you to everybody who inquired about her. Apparently, it was a woman who heard of her story within the last few weeks. Actually, it might have been a little longer than that, but it took this long to make sure she was a match and get everything confirmed, and it came through this week, and so it's going to happen in a few weeks, and that's just the best news. So I thought you might like to hear that update. That's great news to start out here with this week. This was an exhausting weekend. Well, every weekend for me is exhausting, but last weekend was, it's always exhausting. I mean, you run around like a chicken with your head cut off trying to go to all these events, and I didn't even scratch the surface of all the different events that were going on here in New York last weekend. But I never got a chance to talk about the NXT TakeOver show, which a lot of you were very upset about, and the G1 Supercard, both of which I had the pleasure of being in attendance for. I am going to do so here in a second. These are not going to be full-blown match-by-match, blow-by-blow, move-by-move reviews, but I have my thoughts on the matches from these shows. I'll get into that. We also got the Superstar Shake-Up this week to talk about, including what moves I would make or what I think might happen in the Superstar Shake-Up. We got some Vice documentaries, right? Some Viceland documentaries to review as well. But before I get into all of that, I have to start with All Elite Wrestling. The website, therap.com, clarified a story that broke in the wrestling news media this week about AEW having a done deal. Having a done deal, supposedly, with Turner Sports that would likely put its weekly television show on the TNT network starting this fall. In fact, there have been advanced talks between Turner and AEW, but actual contracts have not been signed yet. So it is not a done deal. There are said to be two different proposals on the table for AEW, and this has been the case, I think Meltzer's mentioned this for months now, that they had two more than solid offers on the table that they were reviewing, considering, evaluating for what would be considered to be major cable networks. And the Turner rumor has been around for a while. I mean, even I heard that a few weeks ago, at a show I was at. I mean, the Turner rumors have been around for several weeks now. Jim Ross has kind of danced around it when he's done podcast and radio interviews, and he said, look, there's a huge deal on the table, and, you know, it would be for a two-hour show, and it would debut in October, but I can't give any more details. He's being very coy about it. But that has been the situation for a while now. And the rumor is that Turner Sports is going to present, and this is why this is bubbled up now, present AEW at their television upfronts to advertisers, which is coming up on May 15th. The TV upfronts are basically presentations made by each network to preview all of their upcoming series that are coming out in the fall to potential advertisers. They kind of shop it to potential advertisers. The stars from the shows usually show up there. They do meet and greets, they take pictures, it's a whole big schmooze fest, basically. So that's coming up on May 15th. And the belief is that Turner is going to be, in effect, shopping around this new rumored AEW show to potential advertisers. Now, this is potentially a huge deal, because pro wrestling has not been on the Turner Network since the death of WCW in 2001. And the death of WCW really happened. I mean, it was already on the way down. But what killed WCW at the end of the day was Jamie Kellner. Jamie Kellner was a Turner programming executive who hated wrestling and had no liking for it, did not want it to be part of the Turner Sports family anymore. He was the one who made the call to cancel Thunder and Nitro, which basically killed WCW. It killed the deal that Eric Bischoff had put together with an investor, Fusion Ventures, and that's where that audio you heard at the top of the show comes into play here. That was from a conference call. You heard the audio. They were announcing that Fusion had purchased WCW. They were talking about it as though it were, you know, it was a done deal. And once the television went away, which was the most valuable asset, you know, that WCW had, I mean, you can argue the tape library was, but, you know, at the time, the television is really what gave WCW, if they were going to keep the brand alive, any of the value that it had. So without TV, the investors pulled out because they felt it had no value anymore. If I remember, I think they were gonna sell WCW to them. It was like a $75 million deal, which again just makes you shake your head when you think about the fact that Vince McMahon swooped in and picked the bones and bought WCW for, I think, $2.5 million. Everybody assumed it was a done deal. It just goes to show you the deal is never done until it is done. And I think everybody needs to remember that here with AEW as well. Eric Bischoff thought he had a deal to buy WCW until he didn't. But TNT and TBS are still two of the biggest cable networks in the entire country. USA Network, I think, ranks only slightly ahead of TNT in terms of overall viewership. And TNT is where AEW is rumored to land if the deal is done. You know, Turner has multiple networks. I mean, they have TNT, they have TBS. I think they own Cartoon Network, True TV, which I think used to be the former Court TV. So they have multiple channels that potentially AEW could end up on. I don't know about AEW on True TV, but look, it's possible. I think that would be a huge come down if they were to end up on one of those stations and not TNT or TBS. But TNT is the rumored landing destination. Now, per The Observer, the idea would be for a two-hour live weekly television show, as well as some sort of streaming deal on top of that. You know, TNT has a streaming service, Bleacher Report Live. There could be some tie in there. Maybe AEW big pay-per-view shows end up on the streaming service. There's just a lot of moving parts to this thing. The show would not air on Mondays. It would not air on Fridays to go head-to-head with WWE, which only makes sense. I mean, we all saw what happened to TNA on a strong network. Monday nights, head-to-head. And that was a company with 8 years of being established. TNA at that point had 8 years of history behind it with established names. And they went head-to-head on, look, Spike was a big network. Maybe, again, it was ranked a little below USA, but it was I would consider that a major cable network. And they got absolutely crushed. They got absolutely devastated and had to limp back, I think, to Thursday nights. So, right out of the gate, it would make no sense to put an AEW show that you're trying to establish head-to-head with an existing wrestling show. To go head-to-head would be a terrible way to establish a new brand and to get wrestling fans to check out your show, because we could talk until we're blue in the face about how awful Monday Night Raw is on most weeks. A lot of people watch the show out of habit. Monday night is wrestling night. Monday night is Raw night. They're not going to abandon Raw in large numbers and go watch this brand new show that they've never seen before. Although having names like Chris Jericho and Jim Ross certainly doesn't hurt, which is why I think it was smart for them to sign them up. Now, I was at Raw Monday night at the Barclays Center. I sat in front of two fans, so I had these two guys sitting behind me, in the row behind me. During the main event, when the crowd turned on the show, rightfully, among the chants that they started, and I don't know if this came across on TV or not, I heard it happen during the commercial break, you might have heard a little bit of it on TV. Being there in the building, let me tell you, it was loud. The AEW chants during that main event were loud, they were noticeable, they were unavoidable. You could not be in the building that night and not know that the people were chanting AEW. And when that started, these two guys behind me got really hot. They were just shouting, you're all cheering for a t-shirt company, they're just a t-shirt company, you're all just a bunch of marks. I mean, they were really angry. Like, you would think they had like stock options or something in WWE. They were angry at the people chanting AEW during that main event. As if, and by the way, you know, calling everybody a bunch of marks, as though you're not sitting in a crowd at a wrestling show, but you're going to call other people marks. Not too bright now, are we? But I had to sit there and listen to this for 10 minutes. I mean, like I said, they were very upset. Nothing would make me happier than to be able to shut those people up. But I get it. Some people are just tired of all the hype. They feel that this thing is being way too overhyped. They have not run a single show yet. I get it. But those people need to understand something. This, what's going on here, this is very real. How many times over the years have we heard about, oh, a new promotion is going to sprout up, or Wrestling Revolution Project, or the next, you know, everything's revolutionary, right? Everything's going to change the face of wrestling. Everything is going to make wrestling fun again. And look, Impact's been around for 18 years now, and certainly they've gone through a lot of different, they've gone through a lot of different iterations and ownership changes and things of that nature. And you have something unique like a Lucha Underground that will come along every now and then. Now, Lucha Underground didn't really gain enough traction to survive. I think they're pretty much all done at this point. But I love Lucha Underground. It was something different. It's just too bad it couldn't end up on a major cable network. But, you know, it was a niche show, it was a niche product, but I enjoyed it. And I think we need to see more of that sort of thing in wrestling. But what people have really been clamoring for are something on the level of a WCW, right? I think people, it's nice to have these little projects and these little shows and things of that nature. And a lot of these things are air on Fight TV and other streaming services, so you can watch them. Some put their shows on YouTube. Most, I would dare say that most, you know, indie promotions worth anything, at the very least, put their shows up on YouTube. Like even Booker T does it with his Reality of Wrestling promotion. It puts all of his shows on YouTube. A lot of different promotions do that. It's a big difference between putting your shows on YouTube and being on a network like a TNT or a TBS or some other major station. And that, I think, is what people have been waiting a very long time for. This here is very real. When you look at the money they have behind this project, and you look at some of the big names that they've already signed. Chris Jericho didn't have to sign a contract with these guys. Chris Jericho had the sweetest gig in the world. He had the freedom to be a free agent, to do his own thing, to sign little contracts whenever he felt like going back to WWE and getting a big payday or going to Saudi Arabia, and then he can just leave whenever he wanted to. And he could do some matches in New Japan, and he could do his gigs with Fozzy and do the music thing when he wanted to go on the road and tour and do that. Guy's almost 50 years old. He had the sweetest gig in the world, and he locked himself into a 3-year contract with a totally new wrestling company that is going to compete with WWE on some level. Even if that isn't their goal, it's just natural. There's going to be a competition there. At the very least, there's going to be a competition for talent, right? You can't work for AEW and WWE. A lot of guys are going to have to make a decision. There's going to be WWE people who are frustrated, who want to leave and may end up in AEW very soon. Some big names, potentially. So this idea of competition, it's unavoidable, even if AEW wants to be friendly with everybody. That's not how WWE is going to see it. The fact they got people like Jericho to sign long-term deals and potentially burn bridges with WWE and Vince McMahon says a lot about how serious that he feels this is and that they take things. So they've signed some big names already. You know, and we're talking about serious TV negotiations going on here. We're not talking about Destination America. We're not talking about Pop TV or the Pursuit Channel. These are real networks with a legitimate reach into the tens of millions. So this is not just a t-shirt company. This is the closest thing to a truly major league promotion in 18 years. Since the death of WCW. That's why people are so excited. The death of WCW was the worst thing to ever happen to pro wrestling in this country. Bar none. A lot of people tuned out. They never tuned back in again. A lot of people are unhappy about what WWE is feeding them every week. A lot of WWE performers are unhappy with what WWE is feeding them every week. Seems like every week we read stories about this person being unhappy and this person tweeting, you know, cryptic nonsense and all this other kind of stuff. Every week, people want to see this thing succeed, and there are some people who want to see it fail. Those people are not real wrestling fans. Real wrestling fans want to see more competition in the marketplace, not less. So even if you personally have no desire at all to watch AEW, oh, a bunch of vanilla midgets and indie spot monkeys and this and that, whatever nonsense you want to spout off with at the mouth, fine. You don't have to want to watch AEW, but you should want it to succeed. But they need a TV deal, and they need to get that Vegas show under their belt May 25th. And I think if not at those TV upfronts on the 15th, that Double or Nothing show would be a great time in the building that night to make the official announcement of a new AEW TV show. So hopefully they can finalize things before then. I don't think they could let this drag out beyond that Double or Nothing show. I think they're going to have to make some kind of announcement within the next, where are we now, the 14th? Sometime in the next 6 weeks. They really need to try to make that official announcement to really ratchet up the excitement and prove to people that this is real. This is not fantasy. This is not pie in the sky. This is not, you know, oh, it looks good on paper. That this is real. A Turner deal could be a potential game changer. Plain and simple. No other mainstream network has been willing to give pro wrestling a chance since Spike dropped Impact in 2014. The fact that one, an even bigger one, might soon do so is a reason for, I think, all wrestling fans to be excited. Cautiously excited. But a reason for all of them to be excited. But they have to get the deal done first. Let us learn from the lessons of Eric Bischoff in 2001. It is not a done deal until the deal is done. So I haven't had a chance to talk about the NXT TakeOver show in Brooklyn last Friday. I was there. I was in the building. And originally, I was not going to go to the show. Because originally, it was running head-to-head with the Madison Square Garden G1 Supercard the Saturday before WrestleMania. So I had to make a choice. Which show do I want to go to? Takeover is always a great show, so you know what you're going to get with those shows. But I've been to so many different takeovers, I thought, you know, to go to MSG, first non-WWE wrestling show for me ever in the building, and to see some of the New Japan stars would be really cool. So we got our tickets to go to the G1 Supercard. Up in the nosebleeds, up in the catwalk section, but at least we got tickets. And then WWE, to their credit, decided to move the NXT show to the night before. So TakeOver would run on Friday, and the G1 Supercard would have Saturday night all to itself, other than the Hall of Fame, which turned out to be more eventful than anybody expected it to be. I'm glad I went. I'm glad I was able to go to the TakeOver show, because it ended up being the best show of the entire weekend, WrestleMania included. And I would even go so far as to say that it was the best TakeOver show that they have ever done, with the greatest NXT match in history between Adam Cole and Johnny Gargano, besting even the Gargano-Almas match from TakeOver Philly, which was my previous favorite NXT match of all time. The common denominator here being Johnny Gargano, who simply is on another level right now from pretty much everybody else. They showed Kushida in the crowd during the TakeOver show as their newest signee. He started at the NXT tapings this week. Is he the next Hideo Itami, or can he be much more? He could be much more. Of course he can. He's very talented. He spent, what, I think 8 years in New Japan and became a veteran of the junior heavyweight division. But he wanted to explore things beyond New Japan. It was the same thing we've heard from people like Nakamura and from people like Kenta before. I would certainly hope, judging by the run Hideo Itami had in WWE, that he does not turn out to be a case of the next Itami, and that he could find some success. I think in NXT he'll do well, but beyond that is just anybody's guess. If I had to give these matches on this TakeOver show star ratings, which I don't, but if I did, not a single match on this show was under 4 stars. Yeah, the War Raiders retaining their tag team titles over Aleister Black and Ricochet, who of course won the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic this year. War Raiders won with their fallout finish on Ricochet. This was the NXT swan song for Black and Ricochet. Hanson and Rowe, they hugged him when the match was over. They bowed to them out of respect. Ricochet had tears in his eyes. Of course he had tears in his eyes. He's thinking, please don't send me to the main roster. That's what he was thinking. Hell, I'd be crying too if I were him. But this was fantastic. This tag team, I can't say enough good things about that tag team opener. It was just fantastic. I loved the Velveteen Dream when he came out for his match with Matt Riddle. I loved the Velveteen Dream tribute, if that's what it was intended to be, I don't know, to the Macho King, Randy Savage. Him being carried to the ring like Savage would be back in the day. He even busted out the old double axe handle from the top rope to the floor like Savage used to do, which is what killed his knees doing that over a period of all those years. He was dressed like the Statue of Liberty for his entrance. Riddle, you know, when he came out, actually got some boos early in this match. That's how into the Velveteen Dream the crowd was in Brooklyn. They didn't hate Matt Riddle. They just liked Dream more than they liked him. I thought this was the best match of Matt Riddle's tenure in NXT so far. And maybe even Dream. Dream's had some really good matches, but easily the best match of Riddle's tenure so far. He did give Dream a scary German suplex from the apron. He stood up on the second rope on the inside, and with Dream on the apron, he Germaned him just overhead into the ring, and Dream looked like he landed right on top of his head. Riddle then hit a twisting moonsault from the top for a near fall. He calls that the floating bro. Got him in the bro mission. Dream rolled over, cradled him for the win. Great match. I would love to see more between these two, unless one of them gets promoted in the superstar shakeup. And certainly Matt Riddle, I think, and Dream too. I think both these guys are ready. I think Dream could benefit from having more time in NXT and defending his championship, but you know, if they promoted Matt Riddle to Raw or SmackDown, you wouldn't get any argument out of me. I think the guy is ready, and I think he'll get over. I do, in front of like a mainstream audience. He's got a certain charisma about him that I think it won't be hard for him to get over if he's given a chance. But me, I wouldn't mind these two hanging around NXT for a while and having a couple of more matches. This was great. We had Walter and Pete Dunne for the WWE United Kingdom Championship. 685 days for Dunne as champion. That is where it ends. Walter wins the title in a war. They're live. I thought the match slowed down a lot in the middle, but that was just the nature of the style they were wrestling, I suppose. I did enjoy it. I had this as the second from the bottom in terms of the matches I enjoyed the most. If I had to rank all the matches on this show, this would have ranked probably fourth out of fifth for me. But that is not an indictment of the match. It just is a case where all of the matches on the show were at least very good, you know, if not great in some cases. But I just couldn't rank this above any of the other men's matches. Walter's move is the chop. Many of you know that already. You do not want to be chopped by this man. And so Dunn worked over his hand. You know, it was a very technical-based match. You know, we see this in a lot of Pete Dunn's matches, joint manipulation and that sort of thing. And so, technically speaking, it would make sense for him to work over Walter's hands, which is what he did. Walter kicked out of the bitter end. He powerbombed Dunn off the top rope halfway across the frickin' ring and then hit a giant splash off the top for the win. This felt like a war. This was a war. I'm sure when Pete Dunne woke up the next morning, he didn't feel too good. And stylistically, it was different from just about everything else on this show. Dunne did all he could do as the UK champion. 685 days with that title. He did all he could do. He ought to be included in the Superstar Shakeup this week. And Walter now can carry on the mantle on the UK brand. We had Shayna Baszler retaining her NXT Women's Championship over Io Shirai, Kairi Sane, and Bianca Belair. I thought Shirai was going to take it. I was surprised to see Shayna retain. I thought this would be a great place for her, if she was going to lose at some point, for her to drop the championship, given she didn't have to be pinned for it. And then she can move on up. Kairi and Io got into it a little bit. The two friends did during the match. Shayna choked out Bianca to retain the title. Very good. I thought this was very good, but nowhere near the level of any of the men's matches on this show. This was, if I had to rank them all, this would have been dead last. And then we had Johnny Gargano and Adam Cole, 2 out of 3 falls for the vacant NXT Championship. What I loved, I loved a lot of things about this, but what I loved about this was that when Gargano came out in the building, he was booed. I don't know how it came across on TV, but he was booed by a vocal minority. It was clearly a minority, but still a vocal minority of the crowd. He got scattered boos throughout the building. The people were very much pro Adam Cole. Wasn't that they hated Johnny, it's that they were big into Adam Cole and doing his whole Adam Cole baby shtick and all that when he came out. By the end of this match, what made this so great is despite that, when this match was over, when Johnny won, the place exploded. And that is the sign of two pros who know how to control a crowd and who know how to tell a great story. It was almost 15 minutes before Cole won the first fall with the last shot. Second fall lasted about half that. Cole immediately tapped out to the Gargano escape. So he wouldn't be too badly hurt for the next fall, so he tapped out right away. So now we're in the third fall. Gargano got busted open hard way over his eye. He went headfirst into the ring post. We saw Cole hit Panama Sunrise, which I always love seeing that move. Gargano kicked out of that. Gargano kicked out of a lot of moves during this third fall, which makes this match very polarizing, judging by a lot of the feedback I saw. Because he kicked out of that, he kicked out of the fairy tale ending on the announce table, which did not break. A lot of kickouts. And I think that's why a lot of people either really, really loved this match, or a lot of people really didn't like this match. And if they didn't like the match, it was because they felt there were too many kickouts. I mean, I saw a lot of people shitting on this on my timeline. It was really, there was mixed feedback because of that to this match. And certainly those people are entitled to have that opinion. I'm not always a fan of that either, and I've called that out on occasion in the past. I used to criticize Ring of Honor years ago for it all the time, because they did it in every single match from the opening match on down to the main event. Those old ROH shows from 2006, 2007, you know, 2008, 2009, before they brought Jim Cornette. I remember when they brought Jim Cornette in, one of the things that he wanted to try to change is the fact that you don't go on first and expect to put on a main event match. You had guys going out there wrestling like it was the final match, and they were in the opener. And he said, everything is just sort of going to blend together after a while. You're going to exhaust people, and nothing's going to feel special. So that was one of the changes I remember Jim Cornette implementing when he first sort of took the reins years later in Ring of Honor. And I think he was right in that. I think he made a very good point in doing that. Here, though, in this match, I have to say, you know, it didn't bother me. Maybe I was just so wrapped up in the drama of it. Maybe it's because I was there in the building and I had a different vibe than it would have been if I was watching on TV, which I don't think is the case. But I don't know, maybe. Maybe there's something to that. Or maybe I just felt that it worked. Like in some of the bigger Okada matches in New Japan, where these guys are so, you know, in the story, they're so bound and determined to win the title or to win back the title. On instinct, they'll kick out of anything, right? They'll just... And Okada, in his matches, has a great way of just having this dazed look on his face where it really feels like this guy's just kicking out of moves on instinct. And so sometimes it works. It may just boil down to the performer. Some guys can pull it off. Other guys just kick out of moves indiscriminately. They don't sell anything. And it does just feel like a spot fest. This didn't feel like that to me. It didn't bother me the way that it might bother me in some other matches. It just didn't. You know, all I know is this. It did not ruin my enjoyment of this match, clearly, or the enjoyment of the people in the building who were making a lot of noise. They were into this thing every step of the way. And when Undisputed Era got involved, people booed like crazy. They did not want this match to end like that. And when Gargano fought them all off, it was just fantastic. Cole finally tapped out to the Gargano escape. The place came unglued, which is exactly the kind of reaction I think you would have hoped for after 2 years or so of this man chasing after that championship. Candice came out to celebrate with her husband. He hugged his parents in the crowd. His father was there. I think his health was too poor to make the trip to Philly for Gargano's match with Andrade Cien Almas a couple of years ago. And so him being there was a special thing. And then when the copyright box came on, with the two of them standing on stage, out walked Tommaso Ciampa, neck brace and all, and he hugs Johnny, and he embraces Johnny and Candice, and it's this great hug fest on stage, and he's celebrating with his friends. And I'm fine with that, because anybody who watched the videos they did on Ciampa on WWE's YouTube channel, or maybe it was the Performance Center YouTube channel, which if you're not subbed to that channel, you're missing out. I've plugged it before, I'll plug it again. Great content on there. They've put out a couple of different videos on Ciampa, on his surgery and his recovery and him with his family and his wife and his kid. And I don't see how anybody can watch that and not look at this guy and just think he's the greatest guy in the world. You can't look at him as a heel if you watch those videos. It's obvious they've just abandoned that. And when he comes back, there's a good chance when he comes back, if he's able to come back, because he's had a lot of injuries, and this was a serious surgery that he had. And, you know, Ciampa, I have to say this, Ciampa went on Twitter, and maybe Instagram, a few weeks ago, and flat out admitted that his doctors told him, or his surgeon told him, that he's on borrowed time, which is the same thing they told people like Edge and others who ultimately had to retire early because of injuries. And he flat out publicly just admitted that, hey, I was told I'm on borrowed time. I don't know why you would do that. Now, I'm sure WWE is hip to all this. They've got all the reports and everything, but that's not the kind of thing you would think like Vince McMahon would want to hear and think, hey, I'm gonna promote this guy on my shows. If anything, I think it would deter them from doing anything with him. I'm not convinced that Tommaso Ciampa is ever going to have any kind of career on the main roster. If he's able to come back, he can be NXT bound for the rest of his career. I don't know why you would want to admit something publicly like that, but that was distressing to hear. Because clearly he's on borrowed time, like he said, and is not going to have this lengthy career like you would hope he's able to have. He's just too banged up. He's had too many injuries and too many surgeries, too many miles on his body. But out he walked, he had this genuine smile on his face, and I just thought, I watched these videos, and clearly they have just abandoned any concept of this guy being a bad guy anymore. And so it didn't bother me. And look, it's too bad we couldn't get the Gargano-Ciampa payoff, but what we got instead was the greatest match in NXT history. And you can disagree with me on that, you can have your own personal favorites, that's cool, but don't try to change my mind, because you're not going to change my mind. There's a reason Mauro Ranallo called it the best wrestling match that he's ever called. And you look at Gargano's body of work in NXT alone, and just imagine what this guy could do with some of the big names on the main roster. I think Johnny Gargano, maybe more than any other single person, is going to be the greatest test case of what kind of influence Triple H truly has on the main roster and creative on the main roster with the talent that has been promoted from NXT. You know that Triple H thinks the world of Johnny Gargano. He sees this man's work, and if the day comes that Gargano gets called up and he finds himself in mid-card hell for any extended period of time on that main roster, we will know that it is truly Vince McMahon's show, because there could be no way that Johnny Gargano, or there should be no way that Johnny Gargano goes to that main roster and fails as an underdog babyface. If he is just given the chance, there is no way that this guy is going to fail. He is one of the top, I would even say, three talents that they have right now in that entire company. And I hope they realize what they have in this guy. I really do. G1 Supercard from Madison Square Garden felt weird to be inside MSG for a non-WWE wrestling show, but the place was packed. Other than the seats they roped off behind the stage and screen, the building was packed from top to bottom. Felt like a major league show with the set and the pyro. I didn't get a good view of the set and the stage and all that because of how high up I was. I was in the new catwalk area that they have at MSG since they renovated the building. There was a monitor embedded in the desk in front of me, so I really watched most of the show on TV, if I'm being perfectly honest. I didn't have commentary or anything, but I just sort of, you know, I could glance down at kind of what was going on down there, but I was watching on TV. And this would unfortunately become a theme for me this past weekend. But look, I was happy to be there. I came straight from the House of Glory show in Queens, which was fun. Very cool to see the great Muda live. And also hang out, by the way, with Mish and Joey and Draper from Wrestling Soup. Shout out to those guys. I also walked right past J.J. Dillon and Stan Hansen on my way to the men's room. They were just sort of hanging out, which was kind of weird. But I hauled ass on the train to Manhattan for the MSG show. I got there late, so I missed the entire Honor Rumble. And I was pissed when Minoru Suzuki was not on the show. When the show was over, I'm like, man, Suzuki wasn't even on the show. Only to find out that he was in the Rumble. So I missed him completely. And apparently Muda was in it too. Muda also came straight from the House of Glory show. He got there before me. Even with his bad knees, somehow he beat me to the building. But this it makes me sad that you know, I didn't get to see Suzuki and like Liger, who I was excited to see, and I missed him completely, so that sucked. Then I found out Kenny King won. Kenny King won the Rumble. I was just thoroughly confused by the Ring of Honor booking on this show. Other than Roosh beating Dalton Castle in about 20 seconds, which I totally get, because they're trying to build Roosh, I don't know what they're doing on the ROH side. I don't know. Their booking was very underwhelming on this show. It really, in a lot of ways, was the tale of two. I mean, I'll get into it here, but it was the tale of two shows between Ring of Honor and New Japan. That was the biggest takeaway for me when this show was over, at just the difference between the two sides. Jeff Cobb beat Will Ospreay to win the never open weight title. Great opener. Don't have a whole lot to say about it. I was, you know, they had me engaged the entire time. I loved it. I thought it was a hot way to open the show. What I saw of the women's match with Kelly Klein winning the Women of Honor title back from Mayu Iwatani was not good. I think this was around the time I was distracted by the news that Bret Hart had just been attacked by some fool, by some degenerate at the Hall of Fame. So I was pretty angry. I gotta tell you, when I read that, I was pissed. I was so angry when I read that, and really was distracted for most of the show up until the main events. But this just wasn't very good. And when the match was over, we got a beautiful people reunion, a TNA reunion here with Velvet Sky and Angelina Love. Ironically, an idea suggested by Madison Rayne, who was in Ring of Honor and creatively was not satisfied, and she suggested, why not reunite the beautiful people, but do it in ROH? And she decided to leave the company anyway, to go back to Impact, and they reformed the group without her. And they just added Mandy Leon, so she's part of the group now. The crowd did not like any of this at all. I can tell you that, being there live, I hope it came across that way on TV. They did not like any of this. So who came out to answer Bully Ray's open challenge to a New York City street fight? Was it Suzuki? No. Was it Ishii? No. Juice Robinson had accepted, but he was laid out backstage, so they played it up. Well, it's not going to be Juice. Who's it going to be? It turned out to be Flip Gordon. I know they've been telling this story now for months, and in that respect, I guess it makes sense, but whatever. This ended up turning into a giant brawl with Silas Young out there, Mark Haskins. Juice Robinson did eventually make his way out. Almost 20 minutes they gave this. And if you're into the garbage pail shots and the canes and the weapons and all that, you know, what you would expect probably from a New York City street fight, then you probably like this. I just wasn't into it. Gordon won with the 450. The junior heavyweight three-way was fun for the time that they gave it. I mean, they gave the Bully Ray stuff more time than they gave this. Dragon Lee pinned Bandido to win the IWGP junior heavyweight title held by Taiji Ishimori. And by the way, you're going to have people who say, well, Solo Monster. More people were probably into the Bully Ray hardcore stuff than they would be a random three-way with three guys who were small and maybe some people don't know who they are. It's all about knowing your audience. The crowd at this show was made up of people who, believe me, would want to see Ishimori and Bandido and Dragon Lee get an extra 5 or 10 minutes off the Bully Ray bullshit. It's all about knowing your audience. In front of a WWE crowd, yeah, you might be right. You probably would be right. But not here. So, Dragon Lee is the new champion. One of my favorite parts of the entire show was the entrances for the tag team match. We got the PCO entrance. I thought the PCO electric chair entrance where he's in the chair and they shock him to life. I just thought that was so much fun to see live. 25 years after defending the tag team titles in this very building at WrestleMania, he is back to defend the tag team titles again, this time for ROH. I got a text from my brother when this was over. He was watching at home asking, was that Pierre? Like, he doesn't follow the Ring of Honor stuff a lot. He barely follows WWE these days. And he's like, is that Pierre? And I said, yes. And he goes, he's awesome. I said, I know. He's PCO. He also took a disgustingly dangerous double powerbomb bump from the Gorillas of Destiny out to the floor. That would be a dangerous bump at any age. I mean, it would be a dangerous bump if you were 20 years old, let alone if you're 51 years old. My jaw literally, I mean, it dropped when I saw him just splat on the ground outside like that. Everybody else's did too. I mean, you heard the reaction from the crowd. Oh my God. People thought he was dead. I mean, nobody to catch him. Thin mats outside the ring. Guy's 51 years old. These guys powerbombed the fuck out of him. Almost rolled him up. He almost landed on his head. And then he sat up. And the place erupted. That was the scariest thing I saw, other than, you know, the length of time that WrestleMania went. That was the scariest thing I saw all weekend. Wow. I can't get over that bump. Unreal. You know, I mocked his idea last summer. PCO was giving interviews. He was really starting to get that gimmick over. This is before he signed the contract with Ring of Honor. And he's giving all these interviews and talking about it, this career resurgence that he's having. And he says that his dream match, the match that he really wanted, was a match against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 35. That's the match that he wanted before he signed with ROH. That's the match he was pushing for. And I dismissed it at the time. I said, this guy's crazy. He's out of his mind. I mocked the idea. The more I see of him, and the more I see of this character, you know what? That match doesn't seem like such a far-out idea anymore. I dig it. I mean, it won't ever happen. But the two undead older guys with the big fancy entrances beating the holy hell out of each other, I mean, PCO would probably hold up physically better than The Undertaker would. PCO's out there doing cannonball dives and swantons on the apron, taking power bombs to the floor. Undertaker at least knows his limitations. I don't think he's done his dive out over the top rope since WrestleMania 27. And the only reason he probably didn't do it at WrestleMania 28 is because he was inside Hell in a Cell. He couldn't do it. Thankfully, I don't think we've seen him try that since. But we had a gun stun to Brody King, who's PCO's partner, into the Super Power Bomb, and the Guerrillas of Destiny are now double tag team champions. Ring of Honor tag team champions, IWGP tag team champions. They were my pick to win, so I was happy. And this is where Enzo Amore and Big Cass jumped the railing at ringside as soon as this match ended, and a giant brawl broke out at ringside. With the Briscoes, Bully Ray came back out, they were stiffing these guys with shots, and it was a total work, and I knew right away, within, I'd say, 2 minutes, it was obvious to me being in the building that this whole thing was a setup, and it shocked me how many people watching on TV thought it was real, and I didn't realize that they didn't show much of this on TV. That was by design. They didn't want to show it. They wanted to make it feel more real. But being in the building and watching what was going on, and I was watching security in particular, you can see security never budged during this entire thing. Now, these guys, and look, Enzo, he didn't even jump the railing. He just made a fuss in the front row or whatever row it was at the Survivor Series, was it? And the female security guard tackled him to the ground and they carried him out of the building. You think of Madison Square Garden? These guys jump over the railing, especially after what had just happened earlier in the night at over at the Barclays Center with Bret Hart. This is Madison Square Garden. You think these two fools jumping over the barricade when it wasn't planned, they would just let them go ahead and brawl with the talent at ringside? So that to me was a dead giveaway that this whole thing was a setup. But hey, to their credit, they fooled a lot of people. They probably fooled a lot of you. Good for them. Good for them. And I gave this faint praise for one other reason. Not that I am a fan of these guys being back, and I'm both big Cass and Enzo fans, I could give two shits. But I said it was smart for them to put their differences aside. Enzo has said that when he saw the video of Cass having the seizure at the House of Hardcore show, he just realized, look, life's too short, I gotta reach out to my boy. They made up, because they were on the outs. They had not spoken in a long time, they were not friends anymore. And so they kissed and made up, and they realized that together they can make more money than they can apart. And that's smart. It's true. There are going to be maybe they get a Ring of Honor contract, maybe they don't. Maybe they just work independent shows. Cass and Enzo as a tag team, as a package deal, they will get booked, and they will make some good money. And they're smart enough at least to realize that and put their differences aside. So I kind of credited them with that. As far as, you know, what happened here, I read in the Observer that Ring of Honor didn't even tell the talent that these guys were coming out. So Tama Tonga and Tangaloa are in the ring. They just became dual tag team champions, which is supposed to be a big deal. And their win is completely overshadowed by Enzo fucking Amore outside the ring. What a clown show. They're not even signed to contracts yet. They may not be signed to contracts. But they wanted to get people talking. And look, for one night anyway, it worked. But to not tell the talent and kind of ruin what should have been a big moment, it's just, I don't know. That just reeked of clown show to me. They're calling themselves, by the way, now NZO, so that's Enzo, and Kaz with a Z, XL. They're calling themselves Free Agents with a Z at the end. I love that. Just add a Z at the end of everything. Yeah, I'll add a couple of Z's the next time I see them on TV. But hey, like I said, for their careers, it's a smart move. Judging by the reaction that this has gotten, I don't think it would be maybe the smartest move for Ring of Honor to sign them, but I don't know. Look, you know, sometimes people hate you enough they're willing to pay money to see you get your ass kicked, and I don't know yet if it's that kind of heat they have or if they would chase viewers away from Ring of Honor. Ring of Honor needs something going right now to generate buzz. That's the biggest thing they're missing. Not to the degree of Impact. Impact is practically non-existent. So for all the things I hear about how great the wrestling is and the stories and they've really turned things around, they have no buzz whatsoever. You practically never even hear about them. I wouldn't say Ring of Honor is in quite the same position where they have no buzz whatsoever, but there really is no, I don't know, it just feels like there's no real excitement right now around the product. There was going into this show, but I think that was largely because of the New Japan tie-in. So if it takes Enzo and Cass to piss people off and get people talking about Ring of Honor again, I don't know, maybe it isn't the worst thing in the world for them to be doing. Zack Sabre Jr. retained his RevPro British Heavyweight title over Hiroshi Tanahashi. Used his Napalm Death submission for the finish. Great match, I thought, between these two. I just love seeing Tanahashi make his entrance live at MSG for the first time. Apparently he suffered an elbow injury last weekend. It may have been, I don't know if it was during this match or one of the other matches he wrestled over the weekend, but it looks like he may be missing some time because of that. Kota Ibushi and Tetsuya Naito for the IWGP Intercontinental title. Ibushi wins the gold. Now, of course, that he's actually signed to a contract and he's not just freelancing. He wins the Intercontinental Championship. They put the IC title on him, and the place went nuts for this. This whole match, really, it just felt special from the moment these two got into the ring. You knew they were going to have a great match. I mean, it would be impossible, I think, for these two not to. And they delivered, and Ibushi got the win with the Kamigoye. I love this match. I thought this was the best match on the entire show, with the main event behind that at number two. We had Jay Lethal, Matt Taven, and Marty Scurll, triple threat ladder match for the Ring of Honor World title. Like the Honor Rumble finish, the finish here with Taven winning just, I don't know, it left me baffled. Now they must know that Skrull is probably gone the minute his contract is up, so that may have played into their thinking here. Although I think he still has some time left on his deal. I'm just, I don't know, Matt Taven as the Ring of Honor World Champion? The match was good, but I don't know, never really felt like that big epic main event that you'd hope for in a show like this. Even though they went 30 minutes and they killed each other with some of these ladder spots, there was one point where, I forgot who it was, it might have been Marty, but somebody threw a ladder out of the ring and it struck a fan in the front row. I think it hit him in the knee maybe, or I don't know if it hit him in the arm or the leg, but there was a huge, even from way up, you know, 5,000 miles in the air where I was sitting, you could see there was a commotion going on, and they sent some of the staff at ringside, you know, to ringside to make sure the fan was okay. They probably gave him some free shit. There was a lawsuit chant that broke out inside Madison Square Garden, which is what all of us were thinking. You know, you gotta be more careful than that. I mean, the guy got, he seemed to be okay. He told them that he was okay, but you can't be throwing ladders around like that. So Taven wins the championship, and all right, we'll see where it goes, I guess. I mean, that wouldn't have been my choice for Ring of Honor World Champion, but Jay Lethal's had the title for a while now. Skrull probably is on his way out. Maybe they just felt like he's the best option, but, you know, there weren't too many people when this match was over who were happy with that decision. And then we had the real main event. IWGP Heavyweight Championship on the line. Jay White defending against Kazuchika Okada. Okada wins back the IWGP title inside Madison Square Garden. I got to see an Okada IWGP title win live. So I didn't even have to fly to Japan for it. So I was happy. Long match, even longer than the ladder match. Probably too long. First half, I gotta say, pretty boring. Pretty boring. For as late in the night as it was, I was like, alright guys, we get the point. Pick up the pace here. And then it did. It finally picked up. Now look, I've seen much better Okada matches than this. But this was still a very good match. Rainmaker, Tombstone, Rainmaker for the win. That's 5 IWGP titles now for Okada. I don't know if this aired or not, but Okada took the mic after the match. He thanked the crowd, sent them home happy. The difference in the Ring of Honor and the New Japan portions of this show was like night and day. That, to me, was the biggest story coming out of this. Is that whatever's going to be with All Elite Wrestling, and maybe they can work with multiple promotions, but they better hope and pray, Ring of Honor, that they can maintain this relationship with New Japan. Because I've talked about this before, and I've said, you know, it's mutually beneficial for both sides, and it is. You know, New Japan is trying to expand their footprint in this country, and to partner with a promotion like Ring of Honor is very helpful to them. But the more, after this show was over, I looked at that and I said, you know, in this relationship, I think it's more beneficial for Ring of Honor than it is for New Japan. I could tell you that a lot of the people in the building and in my section and the people who I was talking to were there for New Japan. They were there for the New Japan stuff. Now, on the whole, I liked the show, but without the New Japan stuff, this show would have been a total miss. There's absolutely no chance that they could come back to the Garden for another show like this without the New Japan crew. None. Not unless they want to play to a half-empty building. I don't see it. The show ran almost 6 hours, and if I'm going to take WWE to task, which I have, for the length of WrestleMania, I've got to do the same for Ring of Honor and New Japan. That's just too damn long. I'm sorry. Some people can tolerate it. Just like some people can sit through a 4 or 5 hour football game or other sporting events that go hours and hours. I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't care how good the card is. 4 hours to me is a good length. Or even somewhere in the 4 to 5. You can max out at 5 if the card is good enough. That seems reasonable to me. Anything more than that, it's just too much. It's overkill. You know, the Okada match ended right at midnight. And then I had to hurry my ass over to the wrestling soup event, which was a blast. I'm glad I was able to make it. I thought for a while there I wasn't even going to be able to make it over. And the people couldn't have been nicer. I had so many people come up to me, and Don Tony was there the first time he and I have met in person. He couldn't be nicer. I made sure I sat with my back against the wall just in case, and everything worked out fine. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, everybody there was great. And so on the whole, it was a fun night. I just wish it wasn't so damn long, because, you know, there is a point that you reach where it's just, you feel like it's just overstayed its welcome, and you're just waiting for it to end, or you're just thinking, man, how am I going to get back, or I got to beat the traffic, and I got to get to the train, or whatever the case may be, and it shouldn't be that way. NXT has the right formula. I keep going back to NXT. NXT has the right formula. This takeover show on Friday night that they did before WrestleMania was the longest takeover show I believe they've ever done. I think it went over 3 hours. The NXT shows are never more than 3 hours or 2 hours and 45 minutes. In the past, they've been 2.5 hours. But that, in that range, that's perfect. They never go more than 5 or 6 matches. They've never, until this past show, gone longer than 3 hours. This one, they went a little over 3 hours. And I think part of the reason why the shows are so enjoyable and they just work so well, and people feel really happy coming out of them, obviously the matches, but it doesn't overstay its welcome. They don't wear out their welcome with you. They leave you wanting more. They leave you waiting for the next one. And I think that there's a lesson that can be learned with the main roster. I think there's a lesson that can be learned there with Ring of Honor and New Japan and all of these other companies. Some other notes from WrestleMania weekend fallout from WrestleMania. We had people quitting. We had people supposedly resigning, people being released, injuries, a lot of stuff going on. A lot of people had no idea that R.D. Evans, who used to wrestle in Ring of Honor and in Shikara as Archibald Peck, that included the wrestlers who worked with him in WWE, they had no idea that he even worked for the company or that he used to be a wrestler or any of that stuff. Now, to be fair, I didn't know either that he was working for WWE, and now everybody does. He was tasked with helping put together Bret Hart's Hall of Fame speech. And yes, for those asking, they have people in WWE who help write the speeches for at least some of the inductees. Some, I assume, have the leeway to go ahead and write their own notes, or they just decide not to even use them once they go out there. some guys have that clout. They can do that. But it was pretty obvious that Brett and a lot of the others were reading off of a teleprompter, which may have been one of the reasons why they changed the setup for the Hall of Fame this year. They had it in the ring as opposed to having it on stage. Anyway, he was either told, Evans was either told or it was assumed that Vince McMahon did not want his name to be mentioned during any of the Hall of Fame speeches. He didn't want to be thanked. He didn't want his name mentioned in the context of a story. His name was not to be mentioned. He gets very upset when people mention his name. He's a very weird man, in case you haven't already figured this out. He's a few French fries short of a Happy Meal. Well, Bret Hart went and he did the unthinkable. He thanked Vince McMahon. Oh no. He thanked Vince McMahon in his speech for giving him and Jim Neidhart their first big break. And it was in the speech, and after Bret was attacked and then went on to finish his speech like a boss, Evans, who's worked for the company as a writer since 2016, according to Fightful, got wind that Vince was pissed at him. So it was less a case of him going to the gorilla position and getting chewed out in front of everybody. He heard, hey, Vince is really angry. He's really pissed. And he got the sense anyway that he was mad enough that his job was probably going to be in jeopardy. And allegedly what he did was he walked back to the gorilla position. He shook Vince's hand and he proceeded to quit. It was said to be more of a you can't fire me, I quit type scenario, where he probably would have been fired, and so he decided to quit instead. Evans posted a one-line statement on Twitter saying simply, I quit WWE. That's all he said. Sean Waltman, this all started because Sean Waltman on his podcast, he was there that night, he was inducted as part of the DX induction into the Hall of Fame. He commented that one of the writers was fired backstage for Vince's name being mentioned during one of the speeches. So Waltman claimed the guy was fired. That's what he had heard. Turns out he quit first. Either way, the weird thing about all of this, the whole fucking thing is weird. These people work for a raving psychopath. But the weird thing is that Meltzer had a note in the Observer that said that after all of this went down, before DX went out for their induction to close out the show, Shawn Michaels went to Vince McMahon to ask if it was okay for him to mention his name. And Vince just laughed it off and said, sure, go ahead. Then, of course, DX went out there. They did a whole comedy bit where they mentioned Vince McMahon's name about 50 times. It's like, I hear stories like this, and then I laugh. Every time there is a creative writing opening for a creative position of some kind in WWE, and people will post on Twitter, they'll tag me on Twitter and Facebook. I'm sure they do this with other people and other podcasters as well. But they tag me on Twitter and Facebook. Here, Solo Monster, here's your chance. This is your chance to apply. This is my chance. My chance for what? To want to blow my brains out? Why would I ever want to subject myself to that? Do you hate me that much that you would put that evil on me? Of all the things to be angry about that night, especially after that speech and what happened with Brett, to be upset about that should be pretty low on the list of things to be pissed off about. Imagine being fired for that, or quitting before they could fire you, and then applying for your next job, like a 9-to-5 job. Going in for the job interview, submitting your resume. Oh, I see that you quit your last job. Was there any reason why? Well, yeah, I wrote a speech for somebody that mentioned the chairman's name. He was going to fire me, so I quit. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in that room when he tries to explain that. The good news is that the return of Archibald Peck to the Indies, if he wanted to, could probably be a big hit for the guy. He probably could make some decent money. But my larger point about the Hall of Fame, which I got into during my WrestleMania review, and I'll just get into it again real quick here and now, my larger point still stands. I've been saying this for years and years and years on this podcast. Now, we never had somebody get physically attacked and assaulted during the Hall of Fame. I was talking more just about the fans' conduct and the chants and the interruptions. But now after this, it is even more obvious to me. And by the way, when the attack was over and Brett went back to his speech, there were parts of the speech where you can hear people whistling and catcalling and interrupting. Even after all that, they wouldn't let the man speak. My point still stands. These ceremonies, these events, have no business if they are truly for the talent, to honor the talent and the workers, the wrestlers. It's a night for them to salute one another and to be honored. And it's not just a marketing event. It's not just a marketing tool for the company. That it has no business being held inside large arenas or venues and inviting fans into the building. Now, the reason that it will continue likely to be held inside these arenas is because they do make money off of them. They do sell tickets. And the Hall of Fame was not brought back as anything other than a marketing tool. And that is why they will continue to put it in buildings and they will continue to sell tickets, because they don't want to lose the money. That's what it's all about. It's less about honoring people in a nice little ceremony, which, by the way, they can then turn around and broadcast on the network. They can broadcast on USA. They can put it on DVD with extras. They can make money off it in other ways, but they can't sell tickets. If they take it back into the ballrooms at fancy, swanky hotels, right, they can't sell tickets. These ceremonies should be taken out of the arenas. People do not know how to conduct themselves during the Hall of Fame ceremony because they buy a ticket like they would for any other event. They're sitting in the same buildings that they sit in for Raw and SmackDown and all the other shows where they bring signs and they hoot and they holler and they chant. So they go to these things and they think that they could do the same thing. But that's not what the Hall of Fame should be. If you're going to have these events, and clearly to a lot of these people and the people who are up on stage and put these speeches together or have helped putting them together, it means something to them. They shouldn't have to be constantly interrupted or worried that somebody's going to jump out and attack them because security, you know, isn't fast enough on the trigger. These events should be taken out of the arenas, and I will keep saying it until it's done. And I say that as somebody who actually liked the new setup. I'll probably never do it again after this. When I first saw the setup, I said, oh, that looks pretty cool. I still didn't think it should be held in the arenas, but I thought that looked pretty cool. And now that probably is never going to happen again. Take it out of the buildings. Road Dogg Brian James, who was just inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame as a member of D-Generation X, is no longer the co-head writer of SmackDown Live. He was said to be increasingly frustrated that he was putting in hours and hours of work into scripting these shows, being in creative meetings, Skyping into creative meetings when he was at home, putting in all of this time and effort and to, you know, put these shows together, only for Vince McMahon to basically blow it up on most weeks and make changes the day of the event at the production meetings. And there are conflicting reports now about whether he chose to step down or if he and WWE came to some kind of a mutual understanding that this was the right move to make. It sounds like it's a case where they're simply going to just reassign him to another position. It's not that he's leaving the company or he quit or anything like that, or there's bad blood or animosity there. With the Vince stuff, though, I ask you, every time I hear a story like this, because look, if Road Dogg is one of the heads of creative for SmackDown, he doesn't just give that position up because he feels like it. He gives it up because he and or the company feel that it's just not working out. And it wouldn't be a stretch to think that Vince McMahon and the way he handles things creatively and the way he works these writers, and probably the head writers, no less, probably wore on him and he just had enough. Right? It's not that much of a stretch to think that that's probably what happened here. You hear these stories, and I ask you, who would want to work in a creative capacity for this man? Why? Why subject yourself to that? Why sign up for that, guns blazing? Maybe you've been a wrestling fan all your life, now you've got this great writing position in WWE, and some guys come out of it and they have great, wonderful things to say about the experience. Not everybody comes out of it bitter and sharing stories about how my ideas were never listened to and this and Vince is a terrible human being. You know, they talk about how tough it can be to work for him. But so let me just say that. Not everybody has a horror story when they leave, you know, the creative end of that company. But if you're, let's say, a longtime wrestling fan and you get hired to work in creative as a writer, you come in guns blazing, feeling like you're going to change the world and you're going to make things better. only to have your work ignored or blown up at the last second by this guy for all the work and all the hours you put into it. You know, I said this months ago, I likened it to The Walking Dead. 10 seasons of that show already on TV. Countless showrunners. I think their latest one, Angela Kang, is doing a hell of a job. She did a hell of a job in making this most recent season more interesting than many of the other recent ones. Now imagine having a TV show with the same showrunner for over 25 years straight. It's no wonder that it never feels like anything really changes. It's the vision of one guy. It's the same man. Year after year after year. It's his show. It's his baby. He calls the shots. It's just, it's got to be insanely frustrating to work in that kind of environment, I would think, if you are on the creative end of things. And I can't sit here now and say whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that Road Dogg stepped down from SmackDown or is being, whatever, transitioned into a different role. SmackDown has largely been a better show than Raw, but that doesn't mean it's a great show either. It has its weeks where it's great, and there are plenty of weeks where it's not so great. Now, maybe Road Dogg, they try him out as an agent. Maybe they try him out, I'm reading, as an announcer. Maybe I think that could be a role he would be good at. And look, Road Dogg may have had his share of faults too. Maybe he just wasn't cut out for the job, but maybe, just maybe, at 73 years old, Vince McMahon should not be as hands-on as he is on the creative end of things, on the business end, on the operational end, all the other things he oversees and makes decisions on. Fine, now he's got the XFL he's going to have to oversee and worry about that next year. If we're lucky, maybe that'll take up more of his time and other people can kind of take the reins here, but probably not. This guy has an iron fist. He rules with an iron fist. He has got his tentacles sunk into every aspect of this company, which is admirable in some way, that he would still be as involved and hands-on as he is, but it's maddening. You have this 73-year-old man who is still creatively calling the shots in this company. It's just, it's got to be stifling to work for this guy. How could it not be? How could it not be? Dashabot was released over WrestleMania weekend. She was taken offline. Dasha Fuentes, she was let go. No reason given as to why. WWE has said that after April 2019, they will no longer be supporting her firmware updates. Ronda Rousey broke her hand in the WrestleMania main event. According to Fightful.com, she is slated to undergo hand surgery on Tuesday. And the hope is that she will come back to WWE either later in the year or early next year, but that is entirely up to her. Now, either way, they've got her under contract through 2021. That's from WWE. They, in the past, have said she is under contract through the year 2021. So she's not going anywhere else, but it's up to her if she wants to come back or not. All these reports of her being upset about the finish to the main event, if she was, she didn't show it in the footage that they filmed for her personal YouTube diary. I just watched it last night. It shows her smiling and hugging Triple H when the show was over and hugging and, you know, giving Paul Heyman a kiss. And, you know, I don't doubt that she may have been upset that the finish came off as very awkward and maybe her shoulders were not supposed to be up when they were and it was kind of botched in that way. But I also think a lot of these reports are just overblown. And I'm going to get into that with Sasha Banks here in a minute, but, you know, I don't buy into this idea that she was, you know, on the rampage, on the warpath, angry and pissed off and all this stuff. If anything, she was angry because she had a broken hand. They showed her getting x-rays when the show was over. She thought she broke her knuckle. That's what she told her mother. And then when she went in and you saw the hand, it was all bruised. And it was obvious that it was more than just a broken knuckle. But if Ronda Rousey doesn't come back, or if she doesn't come back until next year, let me just say this. You know, look back on the year that she had. From the moment she debuted at WrestleMania 34, she was in that tag team match, her and Kurt Angle against Triple H and Stephanie. It was the best match on the WrestleMania card that year. She got over just big time in her very first match. And I think she took to this like a duck to water. Some people just take to it quickly. Kurt Angle, Brock Lesnar, these are natural athletes, professional athletes, collegiate athletes, Olympic athletes. And some of them are just wired in a different way. And they just catch on quickly. And Ronda Rousey is in the same category. She had one of the best rookie years that anybody has ever had. Some might say the best. It's hard for me to sit here and rank her year above someone like Kurt Angle. But look, you know, I wouldn't call you a fool if you came to me and said, I think Ronda Rousey, on the whole, had the best rookie year in WWE. You could make that argument. You could say that. She had some great matches. She had some not so great ones, but by and large, she didn't embarrass herself in the ring. I wasn't a huge fan of some of the storyline bullshit they did with her leading into WrestleMania, where she's talking about wrestling being fake and all this other crap. I wasn't a fan of that, but she had one of the best first years that you will ever see somebody have in wrestling, to go from her first match at WrestleMania to headlining WrestleMania. One of the first women to headline WrestleMania is a hell of a feat. So if she never comes back and never does another thing, and I'm sure she will, but if she doesn't, yeah, she'll be in the Hall of Fame one day. Absolutely. But I think she will come back. I hope she does. Because I think that there are a lot of other opponents that she can mix it up with. The horsewomen stuff, you know, we keep hearing rumors about the horsewomen stuff, and I think it's mostly coming from the fans at this point. WWE has teased it in the past, but it's been a long time since they've teased anything with the two horsewomen factions, but that's a match I think that one day they might want to try to do. Of course, they need all the horsewomen in the company in order to do it. And from certain rumors that are out there now, they may not have that luxury. I'll get to that here in a second. AJ Styles was injured during his match at WrestleMania against Randy Orton. He shared a medical update while streaming PUBG online. He was telling people that he sprained his SI joint doing the top rope superplex spot during the match, the suplex he took from Randy Orton. The SI joint is located in the pelvis. I wasn't aware of this. I had to look it up. It is located in the pelvis. He says it's nothing too severe. He just needs to ease up the muscles a little bit and just treat it like a sprain. And he's hoping that it doesn't take too long to heal. All the x-rays came back negative, no broken bones, so hopefully he won't be out too long. Big E, who did two full splits, one on Raw and one on SmackDown, suffered a torn meniscus in his knee, although not from the splits, I don't think. If you watch the New Day main event on SmackDown Tuesday against Drew McIntyre in the bar, there was a spot, a crossbody spot, where Big E tried to catch Cesaro coming off the top rope, and it looked like his right knee buckled underneath him. I'm guessing that's where it happened. So he could be out for up to 6 weeks. Nia Jax is going to be out for a while, a long while. She's having surgery to repair the ACL in both knees. She's been dealing with pain for the past year. She has to have them both taken care of. And look, ACL surgery can keep you out for a long time, and that's just for one knee, let alone two. So I don't think we're going to be seeing her for a while. Sasha Banks may have tried to quit WWE, if reports are to be believed. So let's talk a little bit about her. Sasha and Bayley, less than 2 months after becoming the first women's tag team champions in WWE since the Glamour Girls in 1989, 30 years earlier, dropped the titles to the Iconics in their Fatal 4-Way match at WrestleMania, staying true to the pattern of Sasha Banks' title reigns on the main roster, not lasting very long. It's sort of her thing now. The next night on Raw, Sasha was not there. Bayley was. She lost in a short match, clean in the middle, to Alexa Bliss. This was Alexa's first singles match since September. Instead, Sasha has been on vacation. I assume it was a pre-planned vacation. She didn't just walk out and fly herself to the Dominican Republic, but that is where she has been with her husband, Mikaze, who works as a seamstress. Seamster? What would you call him? Seamster? Like a teamster? Anyway, he makes costumes and outfits for Sasha and other people in the company. So they've been on vacation in the Dominican Republic. They've been posting all these happy photos and these videos all over social media. I feel so bad for her. What a tough life. According to reporting from The Observer and from Fightful.com, Sasha tried to quit over WrestleMania weekend. At some point over the weekend, she tried to quit when she found out that she and Bayley were dropping the tag team titles at WrestleMania. She thought that the two of them were... was led to believe that the two of them were going to have a real chance at a longer reign to try to make those titles mean something. Maybe defend them in NXT, which they had teased doing when they sent them to Full Sail. They cut a promo in the ring at Full Sail, basically all but saying that they would be defending their titles there, and that never happened. And her and Bayley, look, the whole tag team titles thing, they've been talking about this for probably at least a year, if not longer, maybe 2 years. They would do interviews and constantly talk about women's tag team titles. We need women's tag team titles. I think they would look good on me and Bayley for months and months and months and months they talked about these. So clearly they meant something to the two of them, right? They meant something to those two. It was just last May that we heard, I think it was on the WrestleVotes account on Twitter, which is hit or miss. They've broken some news before, they've had some scoops, but not all the time. So, you know, take it for what it's worth. But they reported in May of last year that Sasha had signed a new deal with WWE. Now, let's assume that's true. There's no way that deal was for anything less than 3 years. Some people have signed five-year deals. Kevin Owens, I think, signed a five-year deal with the company last year. So that contract, if she signed a new one, I'm sure was not for anything less than 3 years. Okay? If that's the case, and the news is true that she tried to quit, and supposedly the company's going to give her some time, give her a few weeks to try to come to her senses and reconsider and change her mind and not make any rash decisions. But let's say it's true. Let's say she quits or wants to quit. She's not going anywhere. If she signed a new contract and she's got a few years left on there, she's not going anywhere. Maybe they'll send her back to NXT. She might want to go back to NXT. Good, send her back there. But as far as leaving the company, she's not going anywhere. There is no way that WWE is going to let this woman walk away. Not when you've got AEW waiting in the wings, potentially striking a deal with Turner Sports for a new TV show. They'd scoop her up in a second. No way, no how do they let this woman just leave. So if she really did sign a new deal, she's going to have to suck it up and live with it. Now, Ryan Satin of Pro Wrestling Sheet and the WrestleVotes account on Twitter each reported hearing from sources in the company, and Satin claimed he heard from four different people. He did not approach them. He did not solicit them. They came to him. Four different people who claim that Sasha and Bayley also said to be very frustrated, were so unhappy. This is four different people, allegedly, that Satin was told this by. So unhappy backstage at WrestleMania that they were laying on the floor in the locker room, I guess pitching a fit, and then did the same thing back at the hotel in front of one of their rooms, loudly making it known that they were not happy about dropping those belts. First of all, I don't believe this. Let me just say that. And I'm not saying I don't believe that Satin was told this, but this is just too unbelievable to give any credibility to it whatsoever. Just the mental image of the two of them on the floor, writhing around like spoiled brat. I'm not saying that's what happened, but that's sort of the mental image that you get, right? Writhing around like spoiled brats, stomping their feet, pitching a fit. I don't buy it. And Sasha herself seemed to try to dispel some of these rumors. She posted a photo on her Instagram of her and Bayley posing with the Iconics backstage after their match at WrestleMania. This, to me, it just smells like people backstage with an agenda, spreading gossip, which does happen. So I would chalk, honestly, if it were me, if I had to look at this and say, do I believe this or not, I chalk it up to that. I don't think that happened. I don't doubt that they're unhappy and that she might want to quit. I'm sure all of that is true. But this stuff about they were on the floor and they were making a scene and they were making it loudly clear, first of all, I don't think they have anything but respect for the Iconics. And they're all friendly with each other and always interacting on social media and that kind of stuff. And it would be incredibly disrespectful to publicly act like a child, like a petulant child like that. And what does that say about what you think of your colleagues? How are they going to take that? Like, if you've got a personal gripe, if you've got issues with management and how you're being booked and treated and whatever, and you want to mope around or something, go ahead and mope around, but, you know, take it up with them. You're not going to be on the floor pitching a fit. I just find this impossible, just unbelievable, to think that this actually happened. Even still, I do believe that Sasha Banks has been unhappy with her position for a while now. Here's a woman who, in NXT, held the women's championship for 192 days and had the world by the balls, especially after that Brooklyn match with Bayley. On the main roster, I'm sure it must be frustrating because she's not the focus of anything important, and she probably feels that she can't contribute in a way that makes her feel fulfilled, or that she's contributing to this women's revolution in some meaningful way, or that there's just too much talent and the focus is just not on her enough to where she feels she's being useful and having fun and having a good time. I'm sure all of those things are true. It's also true that she wrestled in a triple threat match at WrestleMania a few years ago to crown the new women's champion after they dumped the Divas belt. It's true that she and Charlotte wrestled the first ever women's Hell in a Cell match and even headlined a pay-per-view with it. Last year was a lost year for her. Last year was a total waste. And she's still young. Look, she's still in her 20s. If she could stay healthy, which is questionable when you see her do some of these dives and all that, but if she, you know, she's still young enough where she's got many more, hopefully, healthy years ahead of her. But even still, you look back on your career, an entire year wasted, that's probably not going to sit well with you. Her and Bayley both. Their 2018 was a lost year. So we'll skip over that. But all those other things I mentioned, right? And then this year. What has she done this year? She opened the year, right, with Ronda Rousey wrestling for the Women's Championship at the Royal Rumble. She won the Women's Tag Team titles with Bayley at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. And she defended those titles on the biggest show of the year last weekend in a giant football stadium. In a short period of time, she's had a lot of major milestones in her career on the main roster. This year alone already has been better than all of her 2018. And yet, she remains frustrated and may be ready to walk out on her dream job and probably a nice salary. That tells me that she really cares. If anything, she probably cares too much about stuff like making those women's belts mean something. Right? Other people might laugh and say, who cares? Like, there's props on a television show. Well, to her, obviously, it means a lot. You know, so you'll get that argument of the belts are just props, stop being marks, and blah, blah, blah. Sasha's a mark, and mark for herself, and a mark. Well, you know, the belts also mean that you're likely to be featured more on the television show. And those belts would allow you potentially to cross over to other brands and work with a wider array of talent. There's different ways to look at this other than, oh, Sasha's a mark. She's a mark for herself. I've heard that this week, too. Maybe so. Maybe she is. But she cares. Probably too much. But I think at the end of the day, she really just wants to wrestle. She wants to be involved. She doesn't want to sit on the sidelines and waste away or feel like she's wasting away and watch other people do what she wants to be doing. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell her what to do. I still think there's hope for them to wake up and start doing something with her. And if they do, there's no bigger platform for her than WWE. But her run on the main roster has left a lot to be desired. And it's not all on her. You could talk, oh, her attitude and this and that. It's not all on her. I don't get the sense that Vince McMahon is a huge Sasha Banks fan. He's never gotten behind her the way that he's gotten behind Charlotte. The way that he's gotten behind Becky recently. Or even Alexa Bliss. Someone Sasha isn't exactly fond of. This feels closer to an Asuka type situation where he just doesn't seem to get it. He doesn't seem to get what he has in her, which is a star, a marketable star. Sasha and Bayley, you know, as a team, has run its course. There's no need for them to be tag team partners anymore. That, the boss and hug connection is one of the cringiest fucking names I've ever heard of for a tag team. Not as bad as Rybaxyl, which sounds like the name of some dick pill you'd see advertised on TV. Do not take Rybaxyl if you've been watching WrestleMania for more than 7 hours. If she stays, the boss and hug shit just has to stop. They need to get back to what made her feel like a big deal, which is the boss persona from NXT. I know they call her the boss every week. We hear Michael Cole every week. It's boss time. It's boss time. Shut the fuck up. But to get back to what that character really was all about in NXT, to get back to that attitude, that's what they need to be doing with her. They need to get back to that. And she needs to be a heel. Feud her with Bayley. Feud her with Becky. Feud her with Asuka. Feud her with Ember. I'd like to see her stay and be happy and contribute and not leave. But if that's not going to happen, then by all means, go ahead. Ask for your release. Do what makes you happy. You're not going to get it, but you could ask. It can't hurt to ask. Maybe you'll catch Vince on a good day where he's feeling very generous. At least then, I wouldn't have to hear Michael Cole shout, "It's boss time," every fucking week. But I can't sit here and criticize this woman for wanting more, because everybody should want more. Some people are master politicians and they can take more, even at the expense of others. Hogan was a master of that. So was Shawn Michaels for some time back in the 90s. People play politics all the time in wrestling. Sasha clearly doesn't have that kind of clout, but if she's willing to potentially give up her dream job, her job security, and a lot of money because she feels so strongly that she could be doing more, she wants to work more, that tells me it's not about the money with her. She really wants to wrestle and not feel like she's having her legs cut out from underneath her every time she starts to get a little bit of momentum on TV. I can't hate on that. I respect that. Is she acting like a diva? Maybe. I don't hang out with her, so I can't tell you. Who knows how much of that is true? You hear those rumors too. Who knows how much of that is true and how much of that is sour grapes? You know what they say, believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. Maybe she is. Maybe she's her own worst enemy. But she's a real wrestling fan. We're all real wrestling fans too. Everybody listening to this is a real wrestling fan, I would hope. Or you're the spouse of a real wrestling fan and you had to get dragged kicking and screaming into listening to this podcast every week, in which case, I apologize. So, look, she's a real wrestling fan. I guess it's not all that surprising that Sasha Banks would be frustrated by what WWE is doing with her. Now it all makes sense. She truly is a wrestling fan. But she's a real fan. And she wants to be the best. This is a woman who sometimes hangs out at the House of Glory school on her days off, training with Amazing Red before some of her big matches. The commitment is there. I respect that. I think Mick Foley said it best. 4 years ago, not long after Sasha moved from NXT to the main roster, he went on Steve Austin's podcast, and he had some advice for Vince McMahon. This is what Mick Foley said. She's living the dream. She's got this character that works, and I think she's being messed with. If you have somebody who is there, who is firing on all cylinders, and I'm talking to Vince, leave her alone and let her do her thing. You're 70, Vince. She's 23. You don't speak to everybody out there just because you don't get it doesn't mean it's not there to be gotten. You have people chanting, "We want Sasha." It's not without reason. Please, Vince, please leave her alone. Let her do her thing. You are looking for faces, future faces of the company. Here's one of them. It makes me sad to see someone work so hard who is there and being led in different directions. That's from Mick Foley. That's something I wish Vince McMahon would listen to now. Because 4 years later, it's every bit as relevant and on point as it was back then. If you're looking for a Raw review from Monday night, I got it up early since I had a few days off after WrestleMania. I went to Raw. I was at the Barclays Center last Monday night. So I was able to come at it from the perspective of somebody who was in the building for a show that largely had the crowd until that main event and that awful little twist that they gave us in the final segment. What a disaster that turned out to be. And then there was some dark stuff after the show that I got into in my Sound Off Extra review with Dean Ambrose saying his goodbyes, one last Shield fist bump, and he had some words for the crowd. And so instead of playing it here, because there's just so much other stuff to get to, it's up on YouTube. If you want to download the audio, the link is always in the video description. You can download it, you can stream it. But yes, my Raw review is not part of the show this week. It was up on YouTube on Tuesday. It is up there. If you have not seen it and listened to it, please go and check that out. I do have some follow-up notes coming out of that Raw show. One thing I didn't mention, I was talking to somebody about this, and I said to him, I said, actually, it's funny you had the same idea that I was thinking of when I was sitting there last Monday thinking, how could they end this, right? Because I didn't think that we were going to get just a straight, clean singles match between Seth Rollins and Kofi Kingston, winner take all with a new double champion crowned. It was a matter of, okay, who's coming out to fuck this up? And one thought that had crossed my mind, given that it was the night after WrestleMania, and so often we see NXT debuts that night. I mean, we got Lars, but, you know, I mean, Lars had already been promoted for so long, I didn't look at that as the big sort of NXT debut. I still thought maybe it was coming. I thought the Undisputed Era was going to run in during the main event and, you know, attack Kofi and New Day and Seth, and that would be their big debut. That at least would have gotten over better than having a DQ fuck finish like the one they gave us. I think if you put those two guys out there, let them go at it for 12 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever and have some near falls and get a really good match going, and then you have Adam Cole and those guys come out and lay waste to them, or whoever was going to come out. But at least you would have given people a match and then hopefully had some kind of a plan for who you sent out there and not just a random SmackDown team. That's what people were most pissed off about. So yeah, the thought of the Undisputed Era coming out there and interfering in the main event and that being their main roster debut, that did cross my mind, and it would have been much better than what they gave us. A certain wrestling Twitter account, and it's not WrestleVotes, this is a different one, which I'm not naming because I don't want to give them the publicity, but they offered a healthy dose of comedy this week, claiming that Dean Ambrose is the $6 million man. He is reportedly mulling over a contract offer from All Elite Wrestling that totals up to $6 million a year for fewer dates than he had working for WWE. Even for twice as many dates as he had in WWE, Dean Ambrose is not getting a $6 million contract. And I would hope nobody listening to this would ever take something like that seriously. If Dean Ambrose is being offered $6 million, then I'm Batman. And I mentioned super schmuck Billy Graham during my Raw review and his dumb comments concerning Kofi Kingston advising him to take steroids and put 50 pounds of muscle on his body. He has since doubled down on his stupidity and clarified, I didn't tell Kofi to abuse steroids like I did, just to take them. It's the era of the small man, he said. Well, thank God above that I was there during the era of the big man, because I want no part of this comedy act that's coming. That was the follow-up from superstar Billy Graham. You haven't been part of the act in 30 years. Talks about it like he's part of the act. He was under contract to WWE, some kind of Legends deal, I think. They were paying him. It was like they were paying him some kind of stipend just for being who he was. And then years ago, they took him off payroll, and he's been bitter about them ever since. It was funny how he warmed to WWE when they were cutting him a paycheck every week, until they weren't, and all of a sudden he turned bitter about them again. But now he posts these Facebook blogs, and I know I give him more publicity than I should with this, but I felt compelled to talk about this because I gave you the first update, and this was the follow-up to that. He doubled down. He doubled down on his comment. And I love how Kofi Kingston, by the way, just won the WWE Championship at WrestleMania, but he needs to take drugs in order to get bigger. Not because he needs it to be successful. He's already the champion. But because it'll make Billy Graham happy. It'll make Billy Graham take him more seriously. Pump drugs into your body that may get you suspended just to please the superstar. This will be the last time I quote anything from this man's Facebook page. I just, like I said, felt the need to... I mentioned his original comments, and I wanted to follow up on them and let you know that he posted something that was even more asinine. This isn't a matter or a debate about steroid use against steroid abuse. I'm not going to get into this debate with anybody. I'm not debating the fact that steroid use in moderation could be beneficial. We're not getting into a medical argument here. That's not what this is about. This is a matter of why in the world would Kofi Kingston take this man's advice when he is having the greatest success of his 11 years in the company? I mean, it's cute that Billy Graham thinks he's still relevant and all, but there's a reason he's not, and it's comments like these. Which is too bad, because he's one of the greatest stick men in the history of the business, and his words may have carried some weight still, even today, if he wasn't spouting off nonsense like this. And barring any kind of breaking news or anything like that, that is the last of him that you are going to hear about on this show. SmackDown Live, back at the Barclays Center on Tuesday, the last Barclays Center show of the week. Twitter poll, over 2,400 votes, 58% thumbs up, 42% thumbs down. A very ho-hum show, felt like a holding pattern really until the shakeup this week. The dark match before the show on Tuesday had Luke Harper beating EC3. who was managed by Drake Maverick, which is a pairing that dates back to their days in TNA, and one that I've been calling for ever since EC3 came to NXT. Not even the main roster, but when he came to NXT. I said I'd love to see them link the two of them back up together and make Maverick his lackey, or manager, mouthpiece, what have you. Now it looks like we may finally be getting it. And it cannot be anything but a positive for EC3. Maverick being paired with the Authors of Pain was just random and just never worked. It just never worked. It was too, like, and there was just no chemistry there. One half of AOP, I forget which one, is still out with an injury, which is why you haven't seen them in a while. And when I think about the great misfortune EC3 has had to endure on the main roster so far when it comes to conspiracy theories, there's a lot of them out there, but I was reminded by Hector and Michael. Two different listeners reminded me about this in the last few days, independent of each other, which is kind of eerie. They reminded me of the Grantland story on TNA that ran in September of 2014. This is a big story. And they reminded me of something I said at the time when I covered it way back on Soundoff 346. In that interview was a quote from EC3 that I thought at the time could come back to bite him on the ass. This is a passage from that article. The mass exodus of wrestlers has left room for young talent, particularly former WWE developmental casualty Ethan Carter III, now a budding main event star for TNA. It's the exact opportunity. This is a quote from EC3. It's the exact opportunity I was ready for a long time ago that I never got over there. I have a chip on my shoulder to shove it up their ass. Every second I'm out there, every chance I get, I'm motivated to make this company succeed. I said it at the time. Those words might come back to haunt EC3. And it makes you wonder. You know, when you get arrested here in this country, they tell you anything you say can and will be used against you. WWE is no different. Now, I'm not saying it was this one comment from this one article that Vince McMahon has had taped to his wall next to his T-Rex head on the wall in his office. I'm not saying that. But if he made similar comments in other interviews and people back who worked for Vince got wind of it and knew about it, or he was making comments like this in his promos, kind of sticking it to WWE, he probably didn't do himself any favors. But, you know, linking him up with Drake Maverick could be just what he needs. Assuming, of course, that they give the two of them TV time on Raw or SmackDown, because without TV time, none of this even matters. We had Aleister Black, Ricochet, and Mustafa Ali on SmackDown, beating Rusev, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Andrade Cien Almas. Reverse Rana on Almas by Ali, and a 450 by him for the win. I was thinking, man, it's cool to see, you know, Ali be the one to pick up the win, and then out comes Randy Orton out of nowhere for a random RKO to lay him out like a jabron. Oh, well. Orton was hilarious. As he left the ring on his way to the back, he was rubbing his eyes and looking up as if he couldn't see. He was basically mocking the company. He was mocking the company for shining lights in all of our faces at MetLife during WrestleMania to the point where we could barely see. We couldn't see his match at all. At least they're self-aware. But if they do the exact same thing next year and they blind people with the same stupid lights, then all they're doing is mocking their paying customers. Kevin Owens then came out. He gave Rusev a stunner. He walked to the back. Maybe they're going to feud him with Orton. But if not, this just felt like a random tag team match and, a random pair of run-ins. Just to get these guys on the show and kill some time until the shakeup. Braun Strowman came out to brawl with Samoa Joe. They got into it. Joe had promised I could take out any superstar, and out came Braun. And yes, Braun is a Raw star. I know they did this as a way to promote the shakeup this week, but, you know, when you see stuff like this, it just reinforces that the brand split does not mean anything. And it gets people excited for matches that in some cases, maybe even here, may never happen. This doesn't mean that Joe's going to be programmed with Braun. They may not end up on the same brand. The whole point of the shakeup is to shake up the rosters. That only matters if the rosters are kept separate and apart from each other. So you ask yourself, what is the point of any of this? What's the point of even having a shakeup? Or a draft? if you don't treat the brand split seriously in the first place. This is the same problem they had with the last split, and this one is no different. And did I not say that? Did I not call that when they said they were bringing the brand split back? I said, it won't take very long. It won't take very long. There'll be a mixing of the rosters. It'll be the same exact situation. They won't take it seriously, and eventually it'll fade away just like the first one did. I think they're going to run with this for a while longer, but you'll see. Inevitably, that's exactly what's going to end up happening. The Iconics beat a local team they called the Brooklyn Bells. One of the women, the one they called Kristen, was Chris Statlander, who has wrestled for Impact. She's wrestled for Shimmer and Ring of Honor, and also House of Glory. That's where I recognized her from. She had at least one, if not a couple of matches there. WWE claimed that they had, the Brooklyn Bells did, have an undefeated record coming into the show of 45-0. And now, after losing to the Iconics, they are 45-1. You know, I also heard through my Brooklyn connections that they have wins over the Fabulous Moolah, and Mae Young, and Trish Stratus, and Rosa Parks, and Hillary Clinton, and Punky Brewster, and Veronica Mars, and Captain Marvel. That's just what I've been told. Shane McMahon came out. He had a mouse under his eye. He was gloating about his win over The Miz at WrestleMania. He was bullying Greg Hamilton some more, trying to get him repeatedly to announce him as the best in the world. I thought this was leading to something. I figured it was leading to a Miz run-in. Miz was not there. Nobody came out. This was just Shane bullying Greg Hamilton and going to the back, i.e., a waste of time. We already know Shane is an asshole. Don't waste my time with segments like this. We've seen him bully Greg Hamilton. I get it. He's a bully. He's a prick. We get it. And maybe it's building to a spot where Greg Hamilton is going to punch Shane in the face or something. They kind of did that with Earl Hebner back in the day when Earl was being bullied around by the McMahon-Helmsley regime and he even got fired. And then they brought him back. And yeah, we've seen angles like this before. But this was such a long segment that had no payoff to it that it just felt like a total waste of time. We did finally get the Hardy Boys Usos match that a lot of us were calling for WrestleMania that we ended up not getting. And it was good for the time that it lasted. Surprising finish. I didn't expect the titles to switch, but the Hardys won their eighth tag team titles together. Usos missed Stereo Samoan splashes. Matt hit the Twist of Fate on Jimmy, and Jeff finished him off with the Swanton Bomb for the win. I like this, and I assume that this was done because the Usos are moving over to Raw. I know Matt Hardy posted a video thanking the fans. They said it's the fans who got this match to happen in the first place. But he was hoping that the Usos don't move, so they could have a rematch, and they could have a 2 out of 3 falls match, and a cage match, and a tables match, and a Hell in a Cell match, and all these kinds of matches. And by the time he was done saying this, I was already sick of this match. It's like, all right, you're overdoing it now, buddy. But I assume they did it because one of them were going to move, and I would assume it would have to be the Usos. Lars Sullivan came out after to lay out the Hardys. Kind of gave me vibes of 2002 when a young monster by the name of Brock Lesnar also tangled with the Hardy Boys when he first debuted as a way to help get him over. The only thing missing here were the sickening chair shots to the head. That Jeff Hardy chair shot on Raw in 02 to Brock Lesnar is still the sickest sounding chair shot that I have ever heard. It is the best sounding chair shot, but the sickest to this day. And there have been a few really sick chair shots. I mean, Ken Shamrock taking a chair to the face by The Rock, Undertaker pasting Mr. Kennedy over the head with a chair and mangling his brains. But you look up the Hardy one to Brock, that's a legendary one for a reason. But you know, I was on Wade Keller's show after SmackDown on Tuesday, and a caller called in, and he asked about the decision to put the belts on the Hardy Boys as a nostalgia act. He referred to them as a nostalgia act. And I disagreed with calling them a nostalgia act. Now, there's definitely some nostalgia there, but these two guys can still go. You know, Jeff's had some singles feuds with Randy Orton and some others. He's had to adapt his style because his body just can't take as much of the abuse as it used to. You don't see him doing swantons on every show. or on all the house shows anymore, but he can still go. And Matt just dropped about 15 or 20 pounds, physically looks to be in the best shape he's been in a very long time. A nostalgia act implies a limited run. Well, they've been back on the roster for a couple of years now and show no signs of slowing down. They're still very popular. So I think it's unfair to just call them, you know, a nostalgia act. They're over. They have the titles now, and maybe with that they can help elevate a new team on the brand. Maybe one that they promote from NXT. But I just thought to call them a nostalgia act, I just felt was very inaccurate and very unfair. We had a virtual repeat of the same angle from Raw the night before, in the same building, with Becky Lynch coming out, cutting a promo, and then being interrupted by Lacey Evans. Not even interrupted, she did her promo, went to leave, and then they played Lacey's music. This time, Lacey punched her in the face, and she must have had a metal plate transplanted into her fist overnight, like Lex Luger's bionic forearm. Because this time she rocked Becky so hard she never recovered. She was stumbling all over like she was punch drunk. But on Raw, when she punched her, Becky never even went down. She kind of laughed it off, and then she charged at Lacey, and they started brawling. Here, you would think that she got punched in the face by Mike Tyson in his prime. I laughed at that. And as far as this being Becky's first feud coming out of WrestleMania, Lacey has yet to wrestle a single match on the main roster. You know, I'm fine with them trying to get a new star over, and I think Lacey is better than a lot of people give her credit for, but it would be way too soon. I mean, for as much momentum as Becky has, you do not job her out or have her drop one of those championships to a woman who has not wrestled a single match, who was promoted from their developmental territory as one of their pet projects. It's not like she's some, you know, veteran they signed who's got 10 or 15 years of experience under her belt, and so to bring her in a hot way, they put the title on her in her very first match. If you're going to book Becky like a top name in the company, like you would any other top name in the company, you would not see any of those top names losing straight up to someone like Lacey Evans. So if they're going to put them against each other, I sure hope the idea is not to just get one of the belts off Becky by putting them on Lacey, or putting it on Lacey. Or as Becky calls her, New Charlotte, which is far too accurate. New Day beat the Bar, and Drew McIntyre in the main event, like the six-man tag earlier in the show, it just felt like, hey, let's throw these guys together for a match to kill time until next week. And yet another example here of a Raw star randomly appearing without explanation on SmackDown. All Sheamus and Cesaro said was, hey, we made a new friend the night before. Oh, okay. Well, then that makes it okay. McIntyre didn't even factor into the finish. In fact, there was a very weird thing that happened here. He vanished midway through the match. He walked to the back. I thought maybe he got hurt. As it turns out, they were running low on time. They knew, and he knew, that he wasn't factored into the finish in any way, so they just had him leave. Had him walk out. Didn't turn on his partners or anything. He just left. Very weird. Kofi hit the Trouble in Paradise on Sheamus for the win, and then celebrated in the ring after with his wife and kids and the rest of New Day. Aside from the tag team title change, if you missed this show, you missed absolutely nothing. Especially if you sat through Raw the night before, you missed nothing on this show. Now, as far as the Superstar Shakeup is concerned, let's talk about the shakeup. That's the big story on TV this week on Raw and SmackDown in Montreal. They're going to be doing the Superstar Shakeup. They're going to shake up the roster. So who do you move? Who's going to Raw? Who's going to SmackDown? What moves would they make? What moves do I want them to make? Do I think they're going to make? So I just put a list together. These are the moves. I guess it's a combination of moves I think will happen and moves that I'd like to see happen. But this is the list that I put together, my personal list, starting with the most significant moves and the biggest name, which is Brock Lesnar. I think Brock Lesnar is going to move, and should move, to SmackDown Live. Even though they're playing up on TV that he may be gone, we don't even know if he's still with the company or if he's going to come back to the company, I don't think he's leaving. I don't think he's going anywhere. And not only that, I still think that him wrestling on that first live Fox show in October, his first SmackDown match, it would be, since 2004. I think that could be a big draw. Promote it in advance for at least a week or two. You promote the fact that Brock Lesnar is going to wrestle on live television, non-pay-per-view, non-special event television, for the first time since 2004. And you promote a big match or a semi-big match with him involved on that first live show. I think that's one absolutely an attraction that you could promote for that first show on Fox. Absolutely. And he's been on Raw ever since he came back in 2012. If anybody was in need of a shakeup to a different roster, it's Brock Lesnar. AJ Styles. I would move AJ Styles to Monday Night Raw. There's nothing left for him to do on SmackDown unless that roster radically changes around him. And I really don't see radical changes happening to the SmackDown roster. Not what I would consider radical. But I think if you're going to move some big names off of Raw to SmackDown, you've got to move some big names from SmackDown to Raw. AJ Styles, what's left for him to do other than move to Raw and mix it up with some new names? So that's a move that I would make. Roman Reigns. Boy, I'm going all in here. Roman Reigns should move to SmackDown Live. Dean Ambrose is leaving, so we're not going to have the full Shield anyway. And unless they're going to turn one on the other, I don't really see any kind of extended feud working with him and Seth Rollins. Again, unless somebody goes heel. I'm not even sure that that's a feud the fans really want to see, that they want to see the two of them go at it. And he's competed now for the Universal title for a number of years. He's been a Raw guy for a very long time. I think you move Roman Reigns over to SmackDown Live. Give him some fresh opponents. Likewise, with one big name moving over, one moves over to Raw. And the name that I would move from SmackDown over to Monday Night Raw is Daniel Bryan. I would move Daniel Bryan over to Monday Night Raw. So that right out of the gate, you've got a bunch of big moves here, right? Brock to SmackDown, Roman to SmackDown, AJ to Raw, Bryan to Raw. You want to shake the rosters up? There's four big moves for you right there. And we're not done yet. Finn Balor, he's got the Intercontinental Championship. They do this every few years, it feels like, where they swap the kind of mid-card titles, the secondary titles. The IC title goes to SmackDown, the US title goes to Raw, vice versa. I would do that here. I would take Finn Balor and the Intercontinental Championship. I would move that over to SmackDown Live. I would take Samoa Joe and his United States Championship and shift him over to Monday Night Raw. Even Steven Switch. Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn is a man without a roster right now. He's back from injury and he's a free agent. He could end up on Raw. He could end up on SmackDown. Where does he go? I say Sami Zayn goes to Monday Night Raw. And if Sami Zayn goes to Monday Night Raw, Kevin Owens should stay on SmackDown Live. I think the two of them need some time apart. Ever since they were both promoted to the main roster, they've been attached at the hip, either as partners or mortal enemies. And I know they were both hurt, and so a lot of time went by, and to some people now, hey, it would be fresh. Guess what the dark match was when SmackDown went off the air Tuesday? Kevin Owens against Sami Zayn. They can't even help themselves. They're back 1 week. Sami Zayn is back, and already they're wrestling matches against each other. I'm tired of it. Split them up. Put them on separate rosters. And I would have Sami go to Raw, and I would have Owens stay on SmackDown. The Usos, I said they dropped the tag team titles to the Hardys on SmackDown this week, I would think, because they're going to be switching brands, and I think they should. I think they've spent plenty of time on SmackDown. They've mixed it up with all the key teams on that show. And unless the entire tag team division is being shook up, I think the Usos should move over to Raw. Aleister Black and Ricochet. Here's two other guys who have been attached at the hip ever since they came to the main roster. They put the two of them together as a tag team. I don't know why, but they've gelled, and they work together very well, and I think they've gotten over to a degree with a good part of the audience so far. And I think now is the time to split them up because long-term, they should not be a tag team. These are not tag team wrestlers. Aleister Black can be a big single star on his own, and Ricochet can be a big single star on his own. It's time for them now. WrestleMania has come and gone. They wrestled for the NXT tag team titles, the Raw tag team titles, and the SmackDown tag team titles in the span of less than 7 days. They were unsuccessful all three times. That's a sign that they ought to put the tag team thing to bed and I think focus on their singles careers. I would keep Aleister Black on Raw and I would have Ricochet on SmackDown. Lars Sullivan, I said this before Lars even debuted. My plan would have been to debut him on SmackDown as the heavy, not lackey, but the heavy for Daniel Bryan instead of Rowan. Well, they went with Rowan instead. Fine. And then, of course, Lars had his own issues. So he ended up being gone for a while. Now he's finally here. He has made his debut. The question is, which roster is he going to land on? I still feel, as the rosters are constructed now, I still feel that the best place for him would be SmackDown. So I would plant Lars Sullivan on the SmackDown brand. Paige. One thing I didn't mention from the SmackDown review is that Paige was on TV Tuesday night claiming that she is going to be bringing a team to SmackDown to challenge or to confront the Iconics. And she walked away. She didn't give any indication of who they were, if they're from NXT or from the UK or where she's bringing these people from. My first thought, and it's still the thought I have now, Kairi Sane and Io Shirai from NXT. I think they're going to be the team that Paige is bringing in, and I think they go to SmackDown. Pete Dunne just dropped his United Kingdom Championship to Walter at TakeOver last week. He did all he could do as the UK champion. There's no reason for him to fight to get the belt back. He has mastered that belt, that division. I think it's time for him to move on up, and I think the place to put him is on Monday Night Raw. That's where I would put Pete Dunne. Asuka. You know my thoughts on Asuka and how they've treated her and what they've done with her, what they haven't done with her. And I think it's a crime. I think it's a shame. And I think it's about damn time that they correct the mistakes they've made. I think Asuka should move from the SmackDown roster to the Raw roster. And she, maybe not right now, but she would make for a great opponent for Becky Lynch, if for no other reason, because she tapped out Becky Lynch. She didn't pass out. She tapped out Becky Lynch. Yeah, the woman who's got two titles over her shoulder at the Royal Rumble. At some point in the not-too-distant future, they need to revisit that. Even if it's just a case of Becky getting her win back, I would like to see Asuka feud with Becky, heel, face, doesn't matter to me, put her on Raw. Get her off SmackDown, get her away from Charlotte, that's the most important thing, and put her on Raw. Bayley. Bayley is also said to be frustrated, much like her partner Sasha Banks. I think Bayley, who lost clean to Alexa Bliss on Raw Monday night, moves to the SmackDown brand. Sasha Banks, meanwhile, unless she decides to leave, and they put her on the bench for the rest of her contract, because I just cannot see them letting her walk away, I say Sasha Banks stays on Raw. There's a theme here. There's a couple of different partnerships and teams I'm breaking up here because they've gotten a little long in the tooth. Owens and Zayn. Black and Ricochet haven't been together that long, but again, I don't think they should be a tag team going forward. So I'd put them on separate rosters. I would do the same with Sasha and Bayley. The boss and hug shit has got to end. Send Bayley to SmackDown. Keep Sasha on Raw. I've seen enough of Sasha against Charlotte. It's been a while, but I've seen enough of it. I would rather move Bayley to the blue brand, keep Sasha on the red brand, turn her heel, and sometime in the next few months, feud her with Becky Lynch. That could be a hot feud. We have not seen a true Sasha versus Becky feud since their NXT days. And they had at least one that I can remember on that one TakeOver special. Great match, maybe more than one. But we know that the two of them put together, you know, could be a lot of fun. It's been a long time, been long enough. I'd like to see it again. Lacey Evans. Lacey Evans, I think, will land on SmackDown. Same brand as Charlotte, so she might have to get a tattoo or something so we could tell the difference between them. But yeah, I think Lacey Evans lands on SmackDown. EC3 with Drake Maverick. Hopefully that becomes a thing, not just in dark matches. EC3 and Drake Maverick, I'd like to see them formally move to the SmackDown roster. Give them a fresh start on there. Rhea Ripley, looking at NXT, NXT UK, Rhea Ripley is a name that I'm a fan of hers, and I would love to see her on the main roster. I think she'll thrive on the main roster. Another blonde, which can't hurt. But according to the website Squared Circle Sirens, she has torn ligaments in her foot. I think she has a cast or a boot on her foot right now. She could be out of action for up to 8 weeks. You know, even still, that doesn't mean they can't move her. That doesn't mean they can't involve her in the shakeup and get her on the main roster, get her talking and doing stuff until she's ready to wrestle. Look, Lacey Evans hasn't wrestled a match. She's been on TV for how many weeks now? So I'd like to see Rhea Ripley on the main roster. If I had to pick a landing spot for her, I'd say Raw probably would be the place I would put her. I'm leaving Undisputed Era out of this right now. When the time comes, I would like for them, and I pitched this earlier when I thought this might happen on Raw Monday night, where they would interfere in that winner-take-all nonsense with Rollins and Kofi, which would have been better than what they did. I'd like to see them, when it's time for them to come up, invade one of the brands and interfere. Not everybody who debuts has to debut in the shakeup or has to have these neat little vignettes that spoil things, you know, weeks in advance of their arrival. It would be more impactful if you're going to call all four guys up at once, to have them just come out at once when people least expect it and make an impact that way. So for them, hopefully that's the sort of thing they have in mind. Hopefully they don't split them up or anything stupid like that. I think they work well together as a group. And we'll see what moves they have on tap for this week. I think I've laid out some pretty big moves here. Again, all of this means nothing if they don't take their own roster split seriously. This was a total joke this week, as far as people coming and going and mixing and moving between brands without any explanation whatsoever. And if that's the sort of thing that they intend to do, I'm not quite sure why it matters if the rosters are shaken up. It's just one big roster. Who cares? You know, how are we supposed to take the split seriously when they don't? So that's the key number one thing I think they have to work on first. I've got some quick documentary reviews. Got three different wrestling documentaries I've watched in the last few weeks. And the first one, which I didn't have a chance to comment on a few weeks ago, was the Kenny Omega documentary, which originally was thought that it was like an HBO thing or an HBO Canada thing. It turned out to be a TSN documentary that aired up in Canada. It's called Omega Man, A Wrestling Love Story. I saw a copy of it weeks ago that somebody shared with me. That link is no longer active, so I don't know where you can go at the moment to go watch this. Apparently, they're going to be broadcasting it in other places soon, and it may get the DVD treatment as well. So I think if you want to watch it, you may just have to sit tight, and eventually it'll pop up somewhere. Omega himself was interviewed, obviously, for this documentary. Chris Jericho was interviewed. I don't know what the hell happened to him. Obviously, he was potatoed in a match maybe the day before. The whole side of his face was all swollen and black and blue. He looked terrible. So they got some comments from him. Don Callis, who of course has been friends with Omega and Jericho for a very long time. In fact, Don Callis is the one who helped facilitate the Omega-Jericho match at Wrestle Kingdom. So he's interviewed. Dave Meltzer is interviewed. Omega's parents are interviewed in the piece. And they cover his early career. You know, they cover some of the time he spent in WWE developmental, why he got into the business in the first place, a lot of the silly stuff that he did in DDT, his philosophy on wrestling in terms of he's very big on telling a story. That's very important to him. And it could be a silly story or it could be a serious story, but that was one of the key focuses of this, is that he takes that very seriously in terms of being able to tell stories, and it's almost like an art form to him. And really, a good chunk of this documentary, I would say most of the middle portion of this documentary, is spent on the friendship, the relationship between Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi, the Golden Lovers, how he first discovered Ibushi, and all the things they have in common, and them together, you know, not just wrestling in DDT, but becoming tag team partners, and the whole storyline in New Japan where the Golden Lovers reunited, which was last year, I believe. Like, all of that is covered. And it leaves you... Now, there's nothing explicitly stated on here as far... Because there were some rumors about him coming out of the closet, or they're going to talk about his sexuality, which I don't give a shit about. But they had footage and comments from a lot of gay and lesbian wrestling fans who thought it was so important to have a story like the Golden Lovers storyline from start to finish in wrestling that kind of touched on themes that resonated with them. And it was always a matter of, are they or aren't they? It's never been explicitly stated or anything that they were more than just tag team partners. But they, you know, you watch this, and especially if you're not a wrestling fan, I mean, you're led to believe that there may have been more there. And again, I don't care. I think it was just a very slick way for them to play things up like that and make people wonder, hey, What's the relationship like between these two guys? Is it more than just a friendship? What's going on here? They made you wonder if you were interested in even knowing the answer to that question. I can understand, I guess, why some people would care about that. Me personally, I didn't. And actually, I think they spent far too much time in this documentary on the whole Golden Lovers thing. Because there was a lot of stuff that I would have liked to have seen them talk about and cover that they just, it's like they didn't have time to get to it. The whole thing is about 45 to 48 minutes, I think, in total, in terms of runtime. It's not an overly long documentary. And, you know, they talked a little bit about Omega winning the IWGP Championship from Okada. They had some footage from All In when he wrestled Pentagon and him backstage after the match, meeting up with Kota in the locker room. But there was a lot of stuff that they just did not take the time to focus on as much, like the series of matches between Omega and Okada, and more comments about that from the two of them. You know, for as big as those matches were to Kenny's career especially, I would have liked to have seen that covered more. But you know what? I'm not sure this documentary was really geared to the audience that would have really cared about that. This was not a documentary that was made really for wrestling fans. It was a documentary that was made for people, if anything, who probably know very little about wrestling and who know very little about Kenny Omega. Because I think it's part of a larger documentary series about Canadian sports figures or Canadian sports heroes. And so Omega was kind of lumped in there. And, you know, probably spending 20 minutes on the greatness of Omega versus Okada, I admit, probably was not for the audience they were aiming for. But, I mean, me personally, it would have been nice for them to focus a little bit more on that because those matches were so big and were so big in his career. Nothing on his decision to sign with AEW over WWE and the negotiations and the deliberations. What is he going to do? Where is he going to go? This was this big drama for so long. And that may just be a case where the documentary was already finished and it was too late for them to incorporate some of that in there. But I think it would have made this a lot more interesting than it was, because I can imagine that it wasn't such an easy decision for him to make. I mean, he had his friends working for All Elite. He probably knew he can get a good money deal. He may have already had a good money offer on the table. But here's his chance to finally go to WWE and get some of the things he's always wanted, to work with New Day or to get a WrestleMania match that he said he's always wanted with AJ Styles, and kind of check off some of those boxes and get paid, I'm sure, a shit ton of money. It could not have been an easy decision for him to make. I'm sure it took some time and soul searching and what am I going to do? What's the right move to make? And it would have been nice for some of that to be incorporated into the documentary as well. On the whole, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. But it was just lacking in some areas. And again, I think they just spent far too much time on the stuff with Ibushi and, you know, the idea, all the kind of the sexual overtones of it and, you know, what it meant to people who, and it's great that there are wrestling fans who felt, you know, that it somehow helped them in some way to have a major act on a wrestling show that kind of they were able to connect with. That's great. But did we really need to spend half an hour talking about this in the documentary? Probably not. Now let's talk a little bit about the Dark Side of the Ring documentaries from Viceland. They premiered this week. It's part of a series of about, I think there's about half a dozen of them. The first two are online. They are free to view. You can watch them right now. The Killing of Bruiser Brody, which is up on their YouTube channel. And The Match Made in Heaven, which is about the Macho Man Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth. That is up. You can watch that on the Viceland website. I don't know if that one's on YouTube or not. So you can watch them right now. The Brody documentary is narrated by Mick Foley. And they have interviews with Tony Atlas, Dutch Mantel, and Abdullah the Butcher. All three of whom were there in Puerto Rico at the, I guess it was a WWC show, the night that Brody was stabbed in Puerto Rico back in 1988. They also have interviews with Brody's wife, Barbara, who, from what I understand, I know she wrote a book, apparently a very good book, about Bruiser Brody that came out a number of years ago. And Brody's son, Jeff, who was a little kid. He was just a little boy when his father was murdered. And in fact, when Tony Atlas is talking about the day of the murder, when it happened, The entire time, he claims that Brody was clutching a small photo of his son in his hand as he was laying there dying on the floor. And clearly, his son still harbors a lot of anger over what happened, as well he should. And he flat out says it in the documentary, they never got justice. And I've heard this story before. I've talked about, at length, the Bruiser Brody story, the Bruiser Brody injustice. I did a whole segment on it once here on the podcast, and it got me angry all over again, listening to these guys talk about what happened that day backstage at the show in Puerto Rico. Tony Atlas was there for the entire thing. He wasn't in the shower stall when Brody was stabbed. He got called into the shower stall by Jose Gonzalez, who played the role of, Invader number one. And he was a star at the time in Puerto Rico and would go on to remain a star for many years. And it goes into details about the different issues that he and Brody had. And, you know, Brody owed him money and he wasn't happy that Brody was gaining power and trying to buy into, like, potentially buy shares of the company, and that he might try to sort of edge out Gonzalez. And Gonzalez had a little son of his own who I think had been electrocuted and died not too long before all this happened. All these things that you've probably heard if you've read about this story before. But the really chilling stuff, obviously, is the retelling of what happened that day. You know, Dutch Mantel was there. He can feel that there was just a very uneasy feeling of tension in the air to where he just left to go walk around. He just couldn't sit in the locker room anymore. He got up, he left Brody, and just was kind of walking around. So when the actual stabbing took place, he wasn't there. He kind of came in the aftermath of it all. Same thing with Abdullah the Butcher. He was there, but had to be told what happened. He couldn't believe it. But Tony Atlas was there. That's the one consistency that's always been part of his story and the overall story in all these years since the incident happened. Tony Atlas was there. He was in the locker room. He saw Brody stumble out of the shower, bleeding to death. And he did what he could to try to help him. Got him down on the ground, trying to put pressure on the wound, shouting, calling for them to get an ambulance. Took 45 minutes for an ambulance to get to that building to transport Brody to the hospital, where ultimately he died on the operating room table. But to listen to Atlas tell the story in great detail about Invader coming out of the shower, having this giant knife in his hand, and then Carlos Colon, the booker, you know, getting into a shouting match with him. Gonzalez leaves, packs his bag and leaves. Comes back later. New change of clothes. He had blood all over his shirt. Now he comes back, change of clothes. Murder weapon is gone. People in the locker room are laughing. This is when he gets back to the dressing room later after helping, you know, get Brody to the hospital. People are in the locker room laughing. Carlos Colon is sitting there. They're all talking like nothing ever happened. It's as though nothing ever happened. And I, you know, when Carlos Colon was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame, that was the last Hall of Fame I probably went to. I haven't been to any of the ceremonies since because it just got so freaking boring. But I'm at the Hall of Fame the year he's inducted. I got up, I went to go take a piss. That's what I think of Carlos Colon being in the WWE Hall of Fame. Do I think that he helped cover things up and is complicit in what happened? You bet your ass I do. And I wasn't there, right? None of us were there. Tony Atlas was there. But you hear the stories about what happened and the way that in shoot interviews he answers questions or then says, I don't really want to answer questions. Yeah, of course you don't. Of course he was a contributor in covering up what happened. What happened there was a fucking injustice. One of the most disgusting things in wrestling history is what happened to Bruiser Brody. So they arrest this guy. And the only reason they arrested Gonzalez was because Tony Atlas was the one witness they had who was willing to come forward and say, I saw what happened. Because the word had spread around the locker room that Gonzalez had stabbed him in self-defense. They saw Brody as this wild man. They figured, well, that must be the way he is in real life. All Gonzalez was trying to do was just protect himself, self-defense. Tony Atlas was the only guy who said, that's bullshit. That is a crock of shit. Let me tell you what happened. He became the lone witness. So they arrested Gonzalez, and they said, we're going to call you back to fly back here to Puerto Rico to testify. And then later on, Tony Atlas comes to find out the trial is done, and Gonzalez was acquitted. He never got a subpoena to testify, or if he did, I think he said it came in the mail weeks later. By the time he got it, the trial was already over. The fix was in from day one. And what's even more maddening about this whole thing is that it's not as though Gonzalez became some kind of pariah in the wrestling industry. He came back and he continued to be a big star and to book and promote and do all of these different things to this very day. The man was never brought to justice. And you hear stories about how difficult Bruiser Brody was to deal with. He was a nightmare for promoters. It doesn't matter. That has nothing to do with the fact that the guy was stabbed to death, laying there on the floor bleeding out. Nobody deserves that. And the fact that this guy continues to just walk around free and is still part of the wrestling business and hasn't been shunned or blackballed or anything like that. There have been other people who've been blackballed for wrestling for a lot less than what this guy did to Bruiser Brody. It is a fucking injustice. And just listening to the story all over again just made me so mad. So it's a dark story. Don't get me wrong. But if you are not familiar with who Bruiser Brody was, if you're not familiar with the story, it's probably as compelling a documentary as you're going to get out of all six or so of them that they've done. It is very well put together. It is very well done. And I also have to say this about Abdullah the Butcher. You know, he says some things in there about there was a discussion about there being a meeting back at the hotel or something about what had happened, which he denies. And Tony Atlas says, oh, is that what he says? Well, he's lying. Abdullah the Butcher doesn't exactly come across as a class A type guy either in this documentary. He comes across like a piece of shit too. There's a lot of bad people involved here. Tony Atlas is not one of them. Tony Atlas is very compelling. And all the other shoot interviews and things when he's talked about this, he's always been very consistent. For the most part, with all of the details and everything, he's been very consistent with what happened. So I would say it's absolutely worth watching. It's not a happy story. It doesn't have a happy ending. But it's absolutely worth checking out. Now, the other one, the other Vice documentary I had a chance to watch was the first one that aired on TV the other night, which was Match Made in Heaven, which was about Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth. This one was narrated by Dutch Mantel. So Mantel is interviewed as kind of an eyewitness in the first documentary, but he narrates this one. And he was familiar with Savage going back to the days of the ICW promotion, which was run by Savage's father and the Poffo family. So anyway, he is the narrator for this second documentary here. I was not as much a fan of this one. And I'm a big Macho Man Elizabeth fan, and it was really cool to see a lot of the old footage of the Mega Powers and the Mega Powers splitting and the snake bite incident with Jake Roberts. They get into all of that stuff. All it is really is just a retelling of Savage's career and Elizabeth's involvement in his career. And it's nothing, if you are a wrestling fan, it is nothing that you already did not know. I learned nothing new watching this documentary that I hadn't already heard. So it was disappointing to me in that way. One of the people they interviewed was Linda Bollea, the ex-wife of Hulk Hogan. Because she and Hulk would hang out a lot with Randy and Liz. Liz would come down and hang out with her a lot. And it also led to a lot of problems between Hulk and Randy, because when Elizabeth basically decided to leave Randy and would go down to Florida to hang out with Hulk's wife, Savage was looking for her, didn't know where she was, because they get into the whole thing about Savage being very controlling. Again, we've heard all this before. But he kind of blamed Linda and Hulk, and that was really the start of a lot of the real-life angst between Savage and Hogan the first time. I mean, they made up, and then they were enemies again, and then they made up. And Hogan claims before Macho Man died, he saw him at the doctor's office, and they made up. It's Hulk Hogan, so who the fuck knows? So they do get into that, and Linda has some photos. Actually, the one thing I will say, in showing some old photos that she has at home in her albums, Linda showed a photo of Vince McMahon without a shirt on. I guess hanging out maybe at the pool at their home or whatever from like 1989 or something. And Vince was jacked even then. You know, God knows what he was doing. Probably like Hogan and the rest of them. But if you think that Vince only got jacked kind of in the late 90s, like later in life, when he got to like the Attitude Era and all that, guy was jacked. Guy was in good shape, I will say. I had never seen that photo before. But again, disappointing in that I didn't learn anything I didn't already know. So when it was over, it was like, oh, okay, I already knew this. And of course, they got into the death of Elizabeth with Lex Luger and, you know, the 911 call. And they talked about Savage finding love late in his life. They didn't even get into the idea that they had known each other from years earlier. He had found like an old high school sweetheart of his. They had reunited later in life and gotten married. And then they talked about the car accident. They had Lanny Poffo. He's interviewed. And they showed him, you know, kind of going to the tree where Savage was killed and laying down some flowers and whatnot. So it was nice. It's not something I really think you have to go out of your way to watch. But if you've got 45 minutes to kill, I could think of worse ways to be spending it. This one didn't really impress me. Hulk Hogan responded to the Savage documentary. He watched it and he commented on Twitter. And I'm sure he wasn't happy about his ex-wife being interviewed, because there is no love lost between him and Linda. But he said, just watched Vice, The Dark Side of Macho Man, 5 out of 10. Really good, but relied too much on a couple of pictures that somebody had, wink wink, and believed stories that were half-truths, which is fucking rich coming from this guy, half-truths and some that were just wrong. What a shame they didn't check all sources, HH. Because without the HH, I wouldn't have believed that that tweet was from Hulk Hogan. I would have thought that maybe his ex-wife hacked his Twitter and posted that. So that's what Hogan tweeted. Now, the reason I mentioned this, the best part of this, and he talks about how they should have gone to the source, and okay, right? Well, the Dark Side of the Ring official Twitter account, whoever runs it, responded. They saw Hogan's tweet, and they replied. And this is what they said. Thanks for watching. We reached out to you to participate in this, but you declined. We would have loved to have had your point of view for the story. Hope we can get you on the next one. Oops. So they asked Hogan, of course, why would they not want Hulk Hogan to be part of it? Hulk Hogan was probably the first person they reached out to. And he said no. Now Hogan's going to bitch that they didn't go to the source? Well, he didn't want to participate. He hasn't responded, by the way. So that was, when I saw that tweet, I just started laughing. I'm like, of course. Of course. Complain about how they didn't go to the source, and yet the source doesn't want to cooperate. So what do you expect them to do? Anyway, the next one is on the Montreal Screwjob, which, if I never hear another word about the Screwjob, I would die a happy man. I'll watch it, but I'm not even really interested in that one. I'm way more interested in seeing the one on Gino Hernandez. I've talked about him a little bit on the podcast over the years. Usually when people send a mailbag question into me about him, I just talked about him a few months ago, actually. One of the great what-if stories in pro wrestling. Had he not died so young when he did, how big could he have gotten? How big of an influential personality in wrestling could he have been? We'll never know. And apparently the one on him is really good, and I have access to it. I can't share it right now, but I have access to it, so I may not wait. I may watch it tonight. If I do, maybe I'll talk about it on the show next week. I'll give a spoiler tag first. And if I have a chance to watch it before next weekend, I might talk about it then. But if you have an opportunity to watch any of the documentaries, by all means, they are well put together. And some of them are better than others, I'm sure. That one, though, is the one that I'm looking forward to the most. There's another one of the Von Erichs as well. Talk about sad stories. I'm sure there's no happiness to be had there in that documentary. Kevin, I guess. Kevin's the one lone happy story. He survived when nobody else did. Anyway, let's get to some quick mailbag questions here, because I really haven't gotten to too many of them the last couple of weeks. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. People this week didn't really do that, but I'll let it slide. This one comes from Parm. I just pulled this before I started doing the show. Would it have been better if John Cena had fought Kurt Angle as Retro Cena instead of doing a segment with Elias at WrestleMania? This way they can get the supposed heel turn in the show, as well as have Angle end his career with a hermeneutic finish. A what? I don't know what that means. A hermeneutic infinite. I don't know what that means. That's not often that I get stumped. I don't know what that word... I have to look it up now. I have to look this word up now. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that the right way. A hermeneutic finish? Let's see. Let's see here. Let's see. Okay. According to the Google machine, definition of this word concerning interpretation, especially of the Bible or... Oh, well, there you go. I mean, that explains a lot. No wonder I've not heard of that word before. You don't have to get all biblical on me, you know. To answer your question, yes. They could have had Thugonomic Cena come out as a surprise to challenge Angle. And they did feud after they had that initial... It's not like they had the one match in 2002. They had a whole feud in 2003 when he was rapping John Cena. And in fact, there's a memorable segment where they battle rapped. Cena came out. He was rapping. Kurt Angle put a backwards hat on or a sideways cap. And he called, I remember, he called Baby Hebner into the ring to beatbox while he did his rap. Those were good times. But that would have been fun. That would have been fun. A total missed opportunity at WrestleMania this year. Let's see here. Travis from Columbus, Ohio. With Kofi Kingston becoming the first black WWE champion. Oh boy. It's going to be some people throwing furniture when they hear that. How about the Raw belt? What do you think of, or who do you think will be the first black Universal Champion? I could see either Bobby Lashley or Big E in that role. What do you think? I don't see either one of them doing it. Lashley's already teasing a return to MMA later this summer, maybe after SummerSlam. But here's a name to consider. I'd put this name down and keep this in the back of your mind. Keith Lee from NXT. It may be a while, but I think he's one to watch out for. Jack from Montana. With Dean Ambrose leaving WWE, what would you say are his top three best matches? Dean Ambrose's top three best matches. Well, I'm going to lump in the Shield six-mans in there because they were matches he was part of, so I think those count. Top three matches. Well, the Shield debut at TLC in 2012, I would put that on the list. That was a great match. It was the Shield against Daniel Bryan, Kane, and Ryback. So I would put that on there. I would definitely put the Shield six-man against the Wyatt family, the first one from Elimination Chamber in 2014. The second one on Raw was great too, but I don't want to put the same match on there twice. So I would say number three, if I picked a singles match of his, I go back to the match, I just reviewed it. It was part of the countdown I just did on the top 10 title matches in Royal Rumble history. He had a great last man standing match to open the Royal Rumble in 2016 for the Intercontinental Championship against Kevin Owens. So I would put that match on there, and that gives you three matches right there. LaToya, we'll end with this. LaToya, who or what? Boy, I'm really, my mind is mush here. What do you think would have happened if Stephanie McMahon agreed to marry The Undertaker while she was on the cross and turned heel? Well, first of all, LaToya, WWE would have you know that it was not a cross. It was a symbol. Of course, they're full of shit, but that's what they would tell you. Just like Goldust when he got electrocuted. He doesn't have Tourette's. He has a neurological condition. It's not Tourette's. Even though it mimics Tourette's. Not Tourette's. What would have happened? Well, I think it would have made for some really awkward holiday get-togethers. That could have made for fun TV. I think Undertaker as the COO wearing a suit on TV every week would not have worked. And I think NXT would have been a very different place than it is right now. That's what I think. Keep sending in those questions. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. Sub to the YouTube channel. If you just type in Solomonster Sounds Off, you'll probably find it. Or you can go to youtube.com/TheSolomonster. We're closing in soon on 50,000 subs. The only way I can get there is if you subscribe. So please do so. There's new content going up there each and every week, including bonus sound off extras like my Raw review this week. You'll notice that was not on the show because it's up on YouTube. Go listen to it. I will be back here with a brand new podcast, episode 596, on the March to 600. That'll be next Sunday. Actually, next weekend's a holiday weekend, so that's going to be a little tough, but we'll make it work. And a big shakeup coming up this week. You can follow along on Twitter. We can talk about it in real time during the shows. And that's it. I will see you guys back here next weekend for 596. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. It's Easter Sunday next week, I think, right? I think it's Easter Sunday. I hope we get to see the Easter Bunny on TV this week. I don't know why. I always laugh when I see that costume. Even when Adam Rose, right, he had the bunny. I always used to get a kick out of it. Or when the APA, he was in the barroom brawl once on a pay-per-view, they kicked the shit out of the Easter Bunny. When I start pitching the Easter Bunny for TV, you know that this show has gone too long. I need some rest. I'll see you next Sunday. Goodbye.
The Salamonster sounds off.
EC3 lost to Tyler Breeze.
I tweeted, that sounds like something you would put on the tombstone of your career.
They never should have called him up in the first place if they had no plans for him. I haven't seen a career fade this fast since Jussie Smollett.
The Salamonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter at Salamonster.
Salamonster. Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster sounds off.